with sometimes the bodily management and with the Arab council that are here in the where we agree on some of the things that we are doing in the industry. I'm not just saying that came from a creative study that I want to bring into the industry. Some of the things are eliminated from the conference which was held a few years back. Number of people that participated in that conference only take this resolution. Now, when they go back to their bosses, they are smart about profit. Look at how best you can make money. Forget about the other things. Money helps. Even if the standard of the voting in newspapers is sliding to tablets as it now is in the country, it's fine. It's money, profit, nothing else. The quality of news, something that they should not be appreciated as much. They themselves confirm that. Not what the community says. But what is important is how best you can make money at the expense of our people. Therefore, we have a responsibility as a community to protect that community. The relative freedom we're talking about that you enjoy today is possible to do together with yourself. Therefore, we must protect those freedoms at the same time. We're not here to create a new censorship and all of that. We're here to try and find a solution to the problem that we're facing. Therefore, I would now afford you an opportunity to present submission today. As you know, it's a normal parliamentary public hearing, but we've been invited. This public hearing did not start today or yesterday. We started last year when we had a roadshow that moved all over the country during the Freedom Public Hearing and the Freedom of Speech. We were doing them concurrently. So we have had the views of the public during the conversation today. So therefore, we'll be informed by your input and the input that is working in the public hearing. We try to come up with some kind of a reachable solution to everything. But what we guarantee you is that the committee will definitely work with you on all the issues that are in the community. And we will find common ground together. Therefore, feel free. One thing that at the end is what we have come to. Therefore, feel free, raise anything you want to raise, any question that you want to raise, and nobody is going to harass you. Thank you. You can then lead us then. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Nolo Letele. I'm CEO of MultiChoice. We are here today, Chair, as broadcasters under the auspices of the National Association of Broadcasters. And before I introduce my colleagues, I'd just like to apologize for being late. I will make no excuses. I stand suitably chastised and I'll have to find a way to make it up to the members of the committee and the members of the audience, hopefully without having to pass on free viewing for 1 month. Just to introduce our colleagues here, we have Johan Costa, Executive Director of NAB. We have Bronwyn Kinyang, Channel Director of ETV. We have Fatih Hassan, who is the Policy and Regulation Head at FABC. We have Karen Willenberg, Regulatory Affairs MNET, and Kwezi Ntengenya, who is Regulatory Affairs at MultiChoice. Jan Rosengarten, Attorney, and Faiza Kathri and Stephen Budlender, advocates, will be assisting us with our presentation today and to clarify some of the points. The presentation outline Just to give you an idea, we'll go through an introduction and Fakir will present the regulatory environment, followed by constitutional concerns, issues relating to subscription broadcasting, and then we'll give our conclusion, and hopefully there'll be time for some questions that we can respond to, Chair. By way of introduction, as you know, Chair, the NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters, this will be a representative of all South African broadcasters in South Africa. And the members include the public, the commercial and the community television and sound broadcasters. So from the very outset, NAB wishes to confirm that its members share the committee's concerns and the ones that you've been recounting just now regarding especially the protection of children. And also, we are supportive of any attempt to eradicate the scourge of child pornography, and we're committed to responsible broadcasting, Chair. At the NAB, all the members have been unanimous in their concern about the extent of the proposed amendments and the consequences, especially for the independent regulation of broadcasting. In particular, the television broadcasting members of the NAB will be directly affected, and these are namely SABC, ETV, MNET, and MultiChoice. And today we are sitting with the NAB under the auspices to convey the concerns of the whole broadcasting community. And it's hoped that this presentation that we will that will ensue, it will assist the committee by avoiding any repetition of the same issues, and also to confirm that the concerns raised are shared by all the broadcasters present today. So without further ado, Chair, I'd like to Fakir Hassan to deliver the regulatory environment issues.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Chair, honourable members, and the audience here. We want to first point out that broadcasting child pornography is already a criminal thing that that is done. It's stated in the Act. And the stated intention of this bill is to deal with child pornography. But under the existing Act, child pornography is defined as persons under the age of 18 engaging or participating in sexual conduct or showing the body of a person under the age of 18 in a manner that can be used for sexual exploitation. I'm sure everyone's familiar with this already. And Section 27(1)(a) of the Act already makes it a criminal offence to possess, create, produce, distribute, broadcast child pornography. There's severe penalties for this, up to 5 years imprisonment. So, since this already applies to all broadcasters, we need to reaffirm that it is currently illegal for any broadcaster to broadcast child pornography. It would be foolish to even try to do this. For any broadcast to operate, members would be aware that ICASA licenses all broadcasters, and the recent ECA, the Electronic Communications Act, already sets certain requirements in place for compliance. The code of conduct that ICASA prescribes, and that's translated into the Broadcast Complaints Commission of South Africa code, and both these codes are almost identical, and copies have been provided to honorable members with the fact that we've been delivered this morning. The NAB has also, at the request of ICASA, recently submitted a proposed code of conduct for subscription broadcasters, a fairly new phenomenon, and later in the presentation, one of our colleagues will expand a little bit on the unique situation relating to subscription broadcasters. All the content that any of us as broadcasters put out as members of the NAB also is governed by a certain other thing, the license condition that ICASA takes in place, again with stringent penalties. I mean, in the extreme, licenses can be revoked if you don't comply with the conditions. And the broadcasters also have their own internal editorial policies. In the case of the SABC, for example, members will be aware that there's a huge public consultation in drawing up a set of policies, especially because it's public broadcast, so we felt the need to do that. The code that we refer to prohibits certain material from being broadcast within context. and these include themes of child pornography, bestiality, incest, rape, violent conduct in some instances, explicit sexual conduct which violates the right to human dignity of any person and which degrades a person and which constitutes incitement to cause harm, explicit intention of or explicit effects of extreme violence which constitutes incitement to harm. And we may also not knowingly broadcast material when judged in context, which amounts to propaganda for war, incite imminent violence, advocate hatred that's based on race, ethnicity, gender, or religion, and which might also constitute incitement to war. So a lot of these things that he points out are prohibited. You can't do this in terms of the source. We also have to avoid broadcasting material and even promotional material which is not suitable for children, which contains nudity, explicit sexual conduct, violence, offensive language before the watershed period that's been prescribed by the DCCSA. We have to clarify the program and state our intention to broadcast, indicating appropriate age restrictions and whether they contain nudity, sexual conduct, violence, offensive language. And here I might just point out here that we ran a highly successful awareness campaign for public information around this, because there was a lot, we believe, of misunderstanding about the watershed, about the symbols that are used, and so on. Broadcasters also have to regularly report the encounter on their compliance with these codes and obligations. As I pointed out earlier, the encounter takes a very serious view of any offense in terms of non-compliance. The code of conduct is administered by the DCCSA, and they also regularly have to submit reports to the encounter on broadcast compliance again, with possible penalties. The code of conduct and the internal editorial policies that are referred to balance the provisions for free speech that are embodied in the Constitution and the obligation to protect minors. They are underpinned by a couple of concepts. One is adequate viewer information that I've referred to, making sure there's a campaign around awareness, the public awareness, and sensitivity and scheduling. Broadcasters take special steps to ensure that public sensitivities are taken into account as well when they schedule the schedule. Regarding the FPB, the broadcasters place great reliance on the classification guidelines of the FPB, and especially regard to movies. In some of our instances, we often go higher than the ratings of the FPB, but obviously we will never go lower than what the FPB. Just last week, ICASA saw in its complaint and compliance committee that the Electronic Communications Act requires, and that's another measure for ensuring compliance by broadcasters. So in conclusion, Chair, we'd like to reaffirm that the broadcast of child pornography is already illegal. It's punishable by up to 5 years in prison. No license broadcaster will submit and broadcast any child pornography. All licensed broadcasters must comply with the code of conduct, which has been approved by ICASA, which also has measures in place for units of measures such. And all these licensed broadcasters are monitored by ICASA to ensure that they use the code. So just by way of getting the link to the background then, I'd like to hand over to Christine Butler that you talk about then about the constitutional concerns.
Before I move on to the substance of the constitutional concerns, I think it might be appropriate to explain my role here. I'm not employed by any of the broadcasters, and I don't work for any of the broadcasters. I'm an independent advocate of the Johannesburg Bar, together with my senior colleague, Gilbert Marcus SC, who will no doubt be known to many of you. We were asked for an opinion on whether the provisions of this bill, dealing with broadcasters specifically, because that's what we did today, whether those comply with the Constitution. And Marcus SD and myself concur that the provisions of the bill fail to comply with the Constitution. They are unconstitutional in three respects with regard to broadcasters, and I'll deal with each of those in a moment. And I'll explain the basis of our conclusion. But in doing so, Chair, I'd also like to point out that what I will hope to demonstrate is that not only are the provisions of the bill unconstitutional, they're also impractical, because they won't be able to be implemented by broadcasters or by the Film and Publication Board. And my colleague, Faiza Khatri, will explain this in more detail with regard to the position of subscription broadcasters when she begins. But, Chair, if I can move to the three constitutional concerns that we've identified. And these are the following. The first is Clause 22C, which subjects broadcasters to the jurisdiction of the board, the Film and Publication Board. The second is Clause 16, which deals with the classification of films. And the third is Clause 24, which deals with the creation of offences. And in our view, Chair, that each of these clauses is unconstitutional and would be invalid if enacted and would be declared as such by the Constitutional Court. But what's important to note is that it's not really just an abstract question of constitutional law. The problem is that the bill we all accept pursues valuable aims and has valuable provisions. But if the bill is enacted in a present form, then some of those valuable provisions and valuable aims will risk being struck down as invalid because they go too far. The baby, as it were, will be thrown out with the bathwater because the bill deals both with issues that are constitutionally acceptable and issues that are not constitutionally acceptable. And that is our concern. We do not want to see important provisions which pursue the critical aim of preventing child pornography and preventing hate speech being declared invalid because they are too broad. And it is with that in mind that we've made our submission. So if I might now turn, Chair, to the three constitutional concerns that we've identified and deal with each one separately to make it clear. And the first is Clause 22C, which subjects broadcasters to the jurisdiction of the Film and Publication Board. And we set out in this slide, Chair, that slide 18, the difficulty. The current provision of the Act, Chair, provides that broadcasters who have a broadcasting license, not anyone who sets up a TV station, you've got to have a broadcasting license, they are not subject to the classification mechanism of the FCB in general. The proposed change proposed by the bill would involve deleting this exemption in its entirety, so subjecting them to the Film and Publication Board completely. And the consequence of that is that licensed broadcasters will have to submit all programs, as we will demonstrate in a moment, all programs to the Film and Publication Board for classification and approval before broadcast. That's the direct effect of the bill. And what this means, Chair, is that the Film and Publication Board is being given the power to regulate broadcasting. Now, whether that's a wise or unwise move is not for me to say, Chair, but what I do submit is that it is clear that that would be unconstitutional, and that is for two separate reasons. The first is that it would involve an encroachment on the role of ICASA. Now, ICASA is a special institution, Chair, because it is protected by Section 192 of the Constitution. That section requires that there be an independent authority to regulate broadcasting in the public interest. And that institution, in terms of the legislation, is ICASA, not the Film and Publication Board. And the Constitution therefore only allows ICASA to regulate broadcasting. And the current Act suspects this by exempting broadcasters from the requirements of the Film and Publication Board. The problem is that the bill as it stands would destroy this carefully crafted provision. It would give the Film and Publication Board jurisdiction over broadcasting. And I submit, Chair, that that in itself is in direct conflict with Section 192. Merely giving the Film and Publication Board the power to deal with regulation of broadcasters violates Section 192 of the Constitution. And that, I submit, would be sufficient for it to be declared invalid. But the problem is exacerbated, Chair, by the second difficulty. And that is that Section 192 of the Constitution requires that any institution regulating broadcasting must be independent. Now, independence in the constitutional context has been a specific meaning. It doesn't just mean that the board must make its own decision. It means that there must be certain guarantees in place, and those are set out in that slide. And the Constitutional Court has on four occasions held that for an institution to be independent, constitutionally independent, it must mean that the executive does not control the appointments of the members of that institution, that the executive does not have the power to remove the members of the institution, and that the executive cannot control the finances, the salaries of the members of that institution. And the problem, Chair, is that the Film and Publications Act was not drafted with this in mind. And so the Film and Publications Board does not satisfy any of these requirements. The Minister has almost complete control over the appointments, removals, and salaries of members of the FPB. And that's not a problem in general, but it is a problem if this bill is to give the FPB jurisdiction to deal with broadcasters. Because what would be happening is that a non-independent institution, non-independent in the constitutional sense, will be given jurisdiction over broadcasters, and that would violate Section 192 of the Constitution. So for two reasons, Chair, it's my submission that Clause 22C is unconstitutional. It subjects broadcasters to the jurisdiction of a body other than ICASA, and that's enough, as I stressed. And secondly, the Film and Publication Board lacks the required level of independence. And therefore, the opinion is that if this clause is enacted as such, it is likely to be declared invalid by the Constitutional Court. Can I pause there, Chair? That deals with the broad issue of whether the Film and Publication Board should be given jurisdiction over broadcasters at all. But even if it were permissible, even if somehow it could be argued that the Film and Publication Board should be given jurisdiction and that that is constitutionally permissible, that takes us to the second constitutional problem, and that is that the classification of film, the manner in which it's dealt with, is unconstitutional. And the problem here, Chair, is the effect of subjecting broadcasters to the Film and Publication Act. Because Clause 16 on its face is innocuous. It says any film must be submitted to the board for pre-approval or pre-classification before it is screened. But film is defined very broadly. It is defined as any sequence of visual images recorded on any substance in such manner that by using such substance, such images will be capable of being seen as a moving picture. So we're not talking about only movies here, Chair. We're talking about every program broadcast on television would amount to a film and would have to be pre-submitted to the board for its approval. And the impracticality of this is demonstrated by the next slide, Chair. Here is a list, I submit, Chair, of the programs that would have to be submitted to the Film and Publication Board for classification and approval before they are broadcast by any broadcaster. Every movie, every newsbook, every episode of every drama and series, every current affairs program, and every sports event. Now, leaving aside any other difficulties, the National Association of Broadcasters estimates that that is 96 hours of new footage per day that would have to be submitted to the board. Leaving aside satellite broadcasters, and obviously if you add the STV in there, 80 channels, 96 hours seems minuscule, but 96 hours of new broadcasting every day would have to be submitted to the board. And so that's just not practical. It's not practical for the board, it's not practical for the broadcasters, and clearly, Chair, this is not what the committee envisaged. The committee wanted to subject broadcasters to the jurisdiction of the STV, but the problem is that because the definition of film is so broad, it means we're dealing with every program ever broadcast on television. But the practical effects go further, Chair, and again I want to stress, whatever the views of constitutional lawyers, these are the practical effects, these are the real difficulties. And the first practical effect is that this will prevent proper news coverage. News coverage, Chair, depends on news being up to date, up to the minute. Delaying news for a few hours, never mind for a few days, preventing the public from hearing what has happened even for a few hours, again, let alone for a few days, is plainly massively undesirable and violates freedom of expression. The public have a right to hear what has happened now, not in a few hours when we've had time to get the administrative processes of the board in place. It also, Chair, will prevent live coverage of all forms, because all broadcasts will have to be pre-submitted. Therefore, all live broadcasts will cease, because you can't pre-submit a live broadcast. So there's no live news, there's no live parliamentary coverage, there's no live current affairs, there's no live sports, and there's no live news. And that is the difference, Chair, between the position of broadcasters on the one hand and newspapers on the other. This committee heard a long debate yesterday about the effect of requiring newspapers to submit certain publications, certain articles, to the board, and there were real problems expressed by newspapers, and the committee took note of those. The problem for broadcasters is far more severe. It's not some articles, it's not some programs, it's all programs, just because of the way the Act is currently formed. But moreover, Chair, I submit that this is unprecedented. We have considered our members, we've consulted our members, and no member is aware of any democratic country anywhere in the world that requires any news bulletin, documentary, and sports event to be submitted to a pre-screening board for approval. But this bill, Chair, proposes requiring every news bulletin, documentary, and sports event being submitted to the STV. And again, we're not suggesting that that was the intention, plainly it wasn't. But that would be the effect if the bill were enacted in its present form. And Chair, when one takes into account the practical effects, the effect on proper news coverage, the effect on all live coverage, and the unprecedented nature, we come to the conclusion, which is that this is unconstitutional. Because Section 16(1) of the Constitution guarantees the right to freedom of expression, and courts in all democratic countries take the view that prior restraint of pre-publication censorship of expression by the government or its institutions is generally unconstitutional. And our constitutional court, which would decide this matter, takes the same approach. I might read that quote. Having regard to our recent past of thought control, censorship, and enforced conformity to governmental theories, we should be particularly astute to ask for any form of source control, however respectably dressed. The point being made there, Chair, it's because of our history that we must be so concerned about censorship. And I'm mindful of your admonition yesterday, Chair, that we should not compare this committee to the apartheid government, and I do not intend to do so. But the point is that the reason we have this guarantee of freedom of expression is because of our past. And therefore, it's in that context that we must be concerned about measures that are overbroad and prevent this from happening. Can I just pause there, Chair? That, I submit, is sufficient for Clause 16 to be unconstitutional. Before we even get into the classification criteria, before we even get into which publications would be banned, the mere fact of having to submit all of these programs for pre-approval, that is in itself unconstitutional. But the position becomes far worse if we look at what the classification criteria say. And that's dealt with on the next slide. And I've just taken one example, Chair. I've dealt with the refused classification. Now, the proposed Section 18.3a deals with refused classifications, and it deals with two issues. The first one is depictions or scenes of child abuse, propaganda for war, or incitement of imminent violence. And the second one is the advocacy of hatred. Now, a refused classification, as the board no doubt well knows, means that the film or the program or the news bulletin cannot be broadcast at all. It will never see the light of day. The public will never be able to see it or hear it, and that will be the end of it. So it's a very severe restriction if the film falls within the proposed Section 18.3a. And if we look at the effect of this, we see that the provisions are manifestly overbroad. Because here are the programs that would be subjected to it. For a start, the provision says it must be a refused classification if it contains a depiction or sequence of propaganda for war. So it doesn't have to be propaganda. It's just got to contain a depiction or sequence of it. Well, see, every movie about the history of World War II and Nazi Germany contains a depiction or sequence of propaganda for war. The movie Hotel Rwanda contains many depictions and sequences of propaganda for war. Those would be banned. News reports by U.S. President George W. Bush, are you with us or against us? We're fighting the terrorists. That's propaganda for war, Chair. No one right-thinking thinks anything different. And so those news reports would be banned. And when we deal with child abuse, Chair, none of the broadcasters before you supports child abuse. On the contrary, they report it. But there are films which are dedicated to showing the evils of child abuse. Films about child labor in India. Films about poor children living all over the world and in our own country who are abused and who are subjected to terrible treatment. Those films contain depictions and sequences of child abuse, and they too would be banned, because there is no defense of artistic merit available to avoid this ban. And Chair, yesterday you raised the question that aren't the restrictions of the bill just the same as the restrictions of the Constitution? But with respect, Chair, the bill goes far further than the restrictions of the Constitution. I've given four examples in the slide. For example, the Constitution prohibits or doesn't extend protection to propaganda for war. In other words, a statement that constitutes propaganda for war, or a film that is propaganda for war. But the bill doesn't limit it only to propaganda for war, actual propaganda. It includes everything that contains a sequence of propaganda for war. So the bill doesn't only prevent people from engaging in propaganda in like the Rwandan context. It prevents a film dealing with that context. The same with containing depictions or sequences of child abuse. The depiction of explicit sexual conduct. None of those, Chair, are dealt with by the Constitution as exceptions. So, whatever the rights and wrongs of what the bill does, we need to understand that the bill goes far beyond the restrictions put in place by Section 16.2 of the Constitution, and that table demonstrates that, Chair. And finally, Chair, on the question of Clause 8 of the proposed Section 18, the Constitution, the provisions, I submit, are unconstitutionally vague. It sounds good in theory to say that films that show disrespect for the right to human dignity should be banned. But how is a broadcaster to know? How is the Film and Publications Board to accurately apply that? What is an act, Chair, that is degrading of human behavior? How is one accurately to know which acts of those are to be permitted and which are not? And so, Chair, the conclusion on Clause 16 is that it is firstly impractical, manifestly so. Secondly, it would prevent proper news coverage. It would prevent all live coverage. It is unprecedented, and it is unconstitutional in a series of respects, and it would be declared as such if it were enacted in the present form. Finally, Chair, the final part of my presentation is Clause 24, which deals with criminal offences. And I haven't obviously given time constraints to deal with each criminal offence, But the criminal offences in the bill tend to have three main problems dealt with in the next slide. And they are the following. The first is that the criminal offences violate freedom of expression. The second is that they are overbroad. They prohibit far too much expression, even if they are dealing with legitimate concerns. And the third is that they are irrational. And I'll explain that in a moment. They operate even if the Film and Publication Court has approved the film for broadcast. And these problems affect most of the criminal prohibitions in the bill. I've given three examples in this presentation here. The first one is broadcasting a non-classified film. If one broadcasts a non-classified film, that's a criminal offense punishable by 5 years of imprisonment. Again, the offense, you must pre-submit every news bulletin, documentary, episode, movie, and sports program to the FBB, otherwise you're criminally liable. I've explained already, Chair, the difficulties in that regard, and that, I submit that that deals sufficiently with this issue. But could we have a look at the second example, and that's films containing sexual conduct? Because the proposed section 24A4, Chair, makes it a criminal offence to distribute films containing depictions, descriptions, or sequences of sexual conduct to persons under the age of 18. But the Act defines sexual conduct as including sexual intercourse. Therefore, no movie containing a scene of sexual intercourse may be broadcast on television because television is accessible to persons under the age of 18. So, any movie containing sexual intercourse of any form cannot be broadcast on television because if it were to happen, the broadcaster would be criminally liable. And this, Chair, applies even if that film had been pre-submitted to the Film and Publications Board and the Film and Publications Board had given it a 16 or a 14 rating. So the Film and Publications Board looks at it, they say, look, the scene is very brief. It's non-invasive, in context it's all right, we're going to give it a 14 age restriction. But in terms of the criminal provision, it's still sexual conduct and it can't be broadcast at all. So even if it's been given an age restriction that's permitted to be broadcast by the board, it still can't be broadcast on television. You can see it in movie theaters, but you can't see it in television. And then finally, a similar example, films depicting the abuse of children. Once there is a depiction or a scene of abuse of children, you can't broadcast it, no matter whether it's been approved, what artistic merits, etc. So the conclusion, Chair, on clause 24 is that the clause is unconstitutional. It violates freedom of expression in a series of respects, it's overbroad, and it's irrational. And the overall conclusion is, therefore, that there are three provisions which are constitutionally problematic. I've now explained them at length. And the problem is that these would likely be declared invalid by the Constitutional Court, which could have the consequence that important provisions pursuing the critical aim of preventing child pornography and hate speech would be declared invalid. But Mr. Chair, you asked us to find middle ground, and middle ground appears on the way forward. Because the way forward, Chair, is not to subject broadcasters to the jurisdiction of the Film and Publications Board with all of the constitutional problems that I've outlined. The way to do it, Chair, is to leave it to ICASA, the constitutionally and statutorily mandated body that is responsible for doing this in terms of the Constitution and the Electronic Communications Act. Leave the current exemption in place, and one can still have proper policing by ICASA in terms of the ECA, license conditions, and obligatory codes of conduct. Chair, those are my submissions on the question of constitutionality. Might I now hand over to my colleague, Faith Caffrey, to deal with the question of subscription broadcasting.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee for this opportunity to make this presentation. I will deal in this presentation with issues that relate specifically to subscription broadcasters, and in particular to difficulties experienced by them relating to implementation. Subscription broadcasters such as Multiport and Centex have additional concerns with the bill, which will have a direct impact upon their ability to operate subscription broadcasting services and to comply with the proposed amendments to the Film and Publications Act. All members of the NAB adhere and subscribe to the BCCSA Code of Conduct. More recently, at the request of ICASA, the NAB, on behalf of the broadcasting sector, submitted to ICASA a Code of Conduct for subscription broadcasting licensees. This code takes into account the particular nature of subscription broadcasting services, which is based on a direct contractual relationship between the service provider and the subscriber. Subscription broadcasting services give subscribers the freedom of choice and the ability to determine the content which they wish to view or listen to, or which to subscribe it deems appropriate for his or family to view or listen to. In drafting the proposed subscription code, the NAD has sought to ensure that where appropriate, the proposed code is consistent with both the legislative framework on broadcasting and the Films and Publications Act. It has further sought to ensure that the proposed code of conduct is consistent with Section 16(2) of the Constitution, including the Films and Publications Act, as regards the content which may not be broadcast. Hence, broadcasters are not permitted to broadcast content depicting scenes of explicit violent sexual conduct, child pornography, content which amounts to propaganda for war, incites imminent violence, and advocates hatred. They are also prohibited from broadcasting material which is classified XX or X18. It is also important to note that the definitions of words and phrases used in the code of conduct accord with those in the broadcasting legislation and, where appropriate, are identical to certain definitions of the Films and Publications Act. Examples of such definitions are those of child pornography and sexual conduct. Now, Mr. Chairman, if I can take you to some of the provisions in the proposed code of conduct. Where Films and Publications Board classification exists, such classification may be used by a subscription broadcasting service licensee. All programs or channels packaged outside of South Africa, other than those which have to be classified as family viewing in the country in which it was packaged, must also be classified. The classification must indicate the appropriate age restriction for viewing or listening to a program. A subscription broadcasting licensee is also required to provide clear and consistent information to its audience about the classification, thus enabling the audience to select programming that they do not wish to view or that they do not wish their children to view. A subscription broadcasting licensee is also required to implement adequate mechanisms to enable a subscriber, using a mechanism such as a PIN code, to block programs based on the classification of the program or channel included in that service. In addition, it is required to ensure that any decoders which it promotes or sells are capable of allowing a subscriber to block any program based on the classification of the program or channel included in the service. It is furthermore required to inform all its subscribers of the parental control mechanisms available to provide the subscriber with a step-by-step guide on how to use it. Mr. Chairman, it is important to bear in mind that this proposed code of conduct was drafted with reference to Section 23(3) of the Films and Publications Act, which exempts broadcasters from the requirements of classification. Its dovetailing with certain provisions of the Act will adequately protect children from being exposed to broadcasting disturbing, harmful, and age-inappropriate material. This proposed code of conduct, as far as subscription broadcasting services are concerned, will prevent the sexual exploitation of children and exposing them to pornography. It is therefore our respectful submission that it is not necessary to amend the current Act in relation to the broadcasting sector. Mr. Chairman, but I now take you to how the channels and bouquets are packaged by subscription broadcasting services. Subscription broadcasters package channels and bouquets which may be broadcast across multiple territories. The content of these prepackaged channels cannot be altered to suit individual territories. Subscription broadcasters are not able to edit or interfere with business models of programming that constitutes these channels. Importantly, channel suppliers do not allow content changes or insertions to a channel without consent. Therefore, a subscription broadcaster has absolutely no control over content of channels that it acquires, Notably, however, subscribers have the ability to prevent the viewing or listening to content on the service and to block content which they deem inappropriate. Chairman, if I can just take you to the activities of multi-choice and how to build, more particularly the amendments to the current forms and publications act will affect multi-choice as a subscription broadcaster. Multi-choice is one of the leading subscription broadcasting services in South Africa. It provides broadcasting services in South Africa to about 1.3 million subscribers and to over 50 other African countries. It acquires channels from South African and international channel suppliers. These channels are packaged for a number of territories spanning 5 time zones. MultiChoice, therefore, cannot tamper with the content of these channels, which include channels such as CNN, BBC, Sky News, Hallmark, National Geographic, BBC Prime, Discovery, and Disney. Accordingly, compliance with a number of the proposed amendments to the bill is impossible for MultiChoice and will have a direct negative impact on the ability of MultiChoice to provide a subscription satellite broadcasting service. Mr. Chairman, you may in this regard ask why. It is important to bear in mind, Mr. Chairman, that the definition of film covers all audiovisual broadcasting content of MultiChoice, including news, documentaries, and movies, on channels received from outside the country, such as CNN and BBC. It is also important to bear in mind that Section 18 requires all films not classified in GEMPIC or approved in terms of the Films and Publications Act to be submitted for examination and classification. If a film is approved for exhibition in public, then the broadcaster is required in terms of Section 18A to display the classification, consumer advice, or any other condition imposed by the board with respect to exhibiting the film in public on all advertisements and all illustrated exhibitions associated with the film. This would be impossible in respect to pre-packaged channels. If the film is not approved, Section 20 provides for an appeal to the appeal board. The appeal board may refuse the appeal, allow the appeal, wholly or in part, or give such decision as the Film and Publications Board should, in its view, have given. The appeal board may also amend the classification of the film and impose conditions in respect of the exhibition of that film. By virtue of the repeal of Section 24A and 24B, the current Film and Publications Act, should a subscription board broadcaster exhibit a film without registering with the board, broadcast or advertise the film which has not been classified, advertise a film of any medium without indicating age restrictions, consumer advice, or any other conditions imposed on the film advertised, and without prior approval of the Films and Publications Board, exhibit in public during the same screening session a trailer advertising a film with a more restrictive classification, then it will be guilty of an offence and liable upon conviction to a fine or imprisonment for a period not exceeding 5 years, or to both a fine and imprisonment. The proposed amendments to the Film and Publications Act therefore impose a harsh sanction for failure to comply with the proposed Section 18. Given the particular nature of subscription broadcasting services, more particularly a subscription broadcasting service such as MultiChoice, it is clear that it would be impossible to comply. Insofar as MultiChoice has no control over the content of the channels it acquires, compliance with classification, age restrictions, and audience advice requirements of the proposed amendment would be improper. The resulting consequences of such non-compliance should be far-reaching and serious. Section 22 of the proposed amendment to the Film and Publications Act provides the board with a discretion to exempt broadcasters from prosecution. If the board decides to exempt a film, it has powers to impose such conditions as it deems fit. Section 18 therefore grants extremely wide powers to the board to impose conditions. Because a subscription broadcaster such as MultiChoice has absolutely no control over the channels that it broadcasts, this would be unachievable. These exemption provisions, therefore, do not address concerns raised by MultiChoice and other broadcasters, as they still constitute prior approval of what may be broadcast. Mr. Chairman, it is precisely for this reason that the regulatory and legislative framework for licensed broadcasters sanctions self-regulation in relation to broadcasting content. Furthermore, ICASA has recognized the need for a different code of conduct from the prescribed code of conduct and the BCCSA code of conduct for the subscription broadcasting industry. The amendment bill, however, does not take into account self-regulation in the broadcasting sector. It fails to recognize the protections against children being exposed to disturbing, harmful, and age-inappropriate material that has been put in place under the BCCSA code, the proposed subscription code of conduct, and the role of ICASA and the BCCSA in enforcing these codes. It also fails, importantly, to recognize the efforts made by the broadcasting industry to comply with these codes. In this respect, subscription broadcasters such as MNET and MultiChoice provide extensive advice to their subscribers, both on the screen and in their TV guides, on the nature of the programming to be broadcast and the classification of such programming. As a further indication of their commitment to ensure that children are not exposed to disturbing, harmful, or age-inappropriate broadcasting content, they provide subscribers with a number of parental control mechanisms to prevent children from viewing inappropriate content. These mechanisms allow a subscriber to block all programming of their classification. Subscription broadcasting services such as MultiChoice and MNET have, as a result of these self-regulatory measures and others such as internal classification boards, been able to comply fully with their obligations under the Code of Conduct. It is therefore our submission that there is no need to amend the current self-regulatory dispensation insofar as it applies to subscription broadcasting services. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to hand over to Johannes Koster to make the concluding remarks.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. Just very briefly and in conclusion, I think you've had quite an earful and it's been a mouthful from our side, so at the risk of being censored very shortly, we'd like to maybe just conclude by saying that I think the message we're trying to get across here is that there are a number of measures in place already for the broadcasting industry. There are self-regulating measures that we take. These are not necessarily voluntary. These are imposed statutory. And these include general content on television as well as the content in advertising. So we are very mindful of your concerns. We support the measures you wish to take. We support the principles that you support. But I think as Lavinda indicated before, we should be mindful that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And that we don't lose these principles, these important principles of protection and constitutional rights and the constitutional exclusions at the risk of these provisions in this law being too wide and too broad. So I think maybe just to say that government stated the purpose for the bill was to protect children from potentially harmful and inappropriate material and from exposure to violence. We support these principles. But unfortunately, the bill as it stands now does not effectively achieve this. And to amend the current legislation applicable to broadcasting services just does not seem to work well when it is unnecessary given the existing regulatory framework and that we're going to create all these constitutional difficulties. We don't believe that the intention of the bill was to create these difficulties, and we should be mindful that when we make these changes, we actually achieve what we set out to do. So, Chair, just in closing then, we'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to appear here today. We hope we've clarified many of the issues for you. We're obviously available to take your questions. But we'd like to reaffirm our support for the work that the committee is doing in protecting children against harmful content. And that the concerns raised by the broadcasting community do not seek to frustrate the goals of the committee, but to ensure that the dynamic broadcasting sector is, as guaranteed by the Constitution, is subject to independent regulation. And that, thank you very much, Chair, to the committee.
Well, thank you very much. Now, let's put aside the bill for now. That is there with this bill, you have your presentation. Can you now deal with your, what is your role in dealing with the issues that you have identified? As you are saying that you understand what is it that you are talking about. Because I would say that you are the people that continue broadcasting issues that you try to address. Now, here you're only dealing with the bill and the unconstitutionality of the bill. Can we put aside your lawyer, I for now, and yourself now to address this issue? What is it that you are doing to address the kind of materials that you are producing? I'm not sure if you want to say, I'm not sure what you are doing. You always know that the we pay for the airtime, but you make money at the same time to access this information and this sort of thing. Let's put aside the law. I just want to hear your role. If your role is trying to address this thing without, you know, picking at the constitutionality, we'll deal with that later. We will deal with that later. But for now, your understanding of this problem and what is it that we're doing. I know that my choice is that, you know, we put some kind of a mechanism to try and, you know, give parent control so that they know themselves that this material is very harmful. Therefore, we create this kind of a mechanism that gives parent control that can log into this thing. If you want to try to maintain it, you know, you're blocked with the thing, which you will have to do. Let's see how that, and how you deal with some of this. Each of you, share with us, especially each of you, what should you are both people that we talked about all the time. You know, this Emmanuel, you know, you look at ETV, 8 o'clock, they are already starting to advertise at 7 o'clock in the afternoon, but late that night, Emmanuel is coming. Dial this number, you get. Tell us, what is it that you are doing? Maybe, you know, we may want to legislate, but at the same time, there's something that you are doing. Maybe so they end up just looking at what you are doing and try to help you to achieve that desire by coming up with this decision. I know FABC, even last time the conference that was held, they demonstrated some kind of a way of trying to not to show effect in some of the things that you're talking about. So therefore, we can expect they want to hear more on the violence that we see on television, pornography that you see on TV. It may not be child pornography, but pornography in general.
Regarding advertisements that you referred to, we also have protection policy internally that we will not show that ad for the cell phone ads. So we don't take it seriously. What we've also done here to address your question about what steps we take in the past year or two, 18 months in particular, mindful of the fact that the constitutional protections both for freedom of expression and the rights of children, and in fact not just children but other audiences as well, to be able to make a choice of what they'd like to see or not see, or allow the children to see or not see. We set about with an awareness campaign, which I'm sure that yourself, members of the community, others in the room have seen across all our radio and television stations in both languages, where we want to create awareness of the watershed period, the responsibility of parents in terms of what their children may watch, and in fact what the symbols mean in the SNDL. And again, I say this was in terms of coverage provisions within the BCCSA code, which creates those obligations for 40% of the. And we'd like to believe that we've had the same measure of success with that in terms of the number of complaints. The SABC, obviously, because of the number of services we have had the greatest number of complaints with the BCCSA. And in the year before we started the awareness campaign, 92% of complaints were dismissed in our favor at the BCCSA. In the past year, when this campaign was running, which has just ended in March this year, that figure has gone to 98%. So only in 2% of the cases were there transgressions of the code, but in 98% of the cases it was dismissed. So one of the factors we submit was the awareness campaign that we set up with the
Plus, I think you've noted that question. Let's just allow the research to demonstrate their commitment to the challenge that you're doing. And then from there, members will come to the studio. So let's take the next conference, the ETV.
From ETV
point
of view, as Patrick
Hall
said, in the presentation, we follow the same code and are subject to the same regulation as all other broadcasters. We abide by the watershed period, which requires that the program that is not suitable for children is not broadcast before a certain time, and that includes the promotion of that material. We do not advertise adult content before 9 p.m. That is an internal code that ETV has set for itself as well. We have internal codes of conduct which apply to both the classification of films that are broadcast on ETV, as well as the classification of SMS advertisements that are broadcast on ETV, and we publish those classifications. In fact, any adult content which is broadcast after 11 p.m. is preceded by a very clear warning to parents, and also we have on for the duration of the program, we have a classification on screen which explains that it's not for persons under the age of 18. I can also say that a few years ago, probably about 5 or 6 years ago, there was a ruling against ETV on its adult content, in terms of which the BCCSA required ETV to schedule such programming only after 11 p.m. And I'm happy to say that we complied with that, and we have not had any complaints about adult content upheld against us at the BCCSA since that day.
Thank you, Chairperson, members of the committee. Indeed, Chairperson, I think Clive has articulated exactly what smart choice are. We've got very extensive warning measures. It's well and good to have all of those, but if people do not know how to use those, unfortunately, they're not have. So we've got very extensive campaigns to inform and educate our subscribers on the use of those mechanisms. And it is like fellow ones for us.
So that's how you run the company. So person, we've got, firstly, we use our dish, what is called a dish magazine, you know, the squattle, the squattle. When we write at the back, we've got a section which basically gives extensive information about how, for instance, you activate the PIN using the PIN number to block whatever material that you do not want your kids to have on. From time to time, we dedicate some of the channels where we run programming, like sort of like a promotional promo on the use of our EPG, on the use of the guideline, what it means, the symbols, and also. So we use both the written, the form of the dish, and also on air campaign from time to time, Jefferson.
Measure the success of those campaigns, the kind of how do you measure the success of your campaign? Nobody can do this, therefore you are able to allow me to do that.
Jefferson, you know, when you run a subscription service, I mean, you do, I suppose, other broadcasts as well, you do ongoing research. Subscribers tend to be fairly conservative, and some of the time, people do not want material that is unsuitable for sharing. So we run those research. We don't do this. When you do the campaign, we make sure that, I mean, we can measure those. We read the data, and we readjust our program. The most critical aspect, which also gives us a lot of indication, is really the calls that come through our call center. We find that because we run all these campaigns, the level of complaints that we get in relation to undesirable content is very, very low, extremely low. In fact, complaints around the content that is shown across the DSTV constitutes only 1% of the complaints we get. And we do mostly get complaints around the billing, technical issues, and all of that. But in relation to the content, and particularly undesirable content, we've got very, very minimal.
I just wanted to have a feel of the understanding of the sort of part of our position therefore, the signal on the hand, and then from there we give members of the committee, so we can open up the meeting again for questions and clarities.
Sorry, Chair, there's just one issue I didn't raise from the pre-TV broadcasting side, is that, I don't know, not sure if the committee are aware, but the Department of Communications is driving a process to launch digital terrestrial television from November next year. Digital terrestrial television will require set-top boxes to decode the signal from digital to analog, and those boxes will most probably have parental control mechanisms in them, so that even for free television services like the SABC and ETV, that kind of parental control that subscription broadcasters are able to implement will be available to us as well.
Okay, let me start with you, Jose Moramuche, with my Colombia.
It has reminded me that, by the way, we're dealing with news leakers, and you can't beat them at any given time. And as I was listening to them, they are putting emphasis on saying already there are mechanisms in place which have got fines if one breaks the law. That's what they are putting before us. Secondly, they say if we their analogy will be the broadcaster will be crashing on the terrain of the cutter in certain cases, which they are pushing all the issues which have been raised in the amendment to say the cutter assesses and analyzes that the bees are supposed to be seized and so forth and so forth. So my question now, sir, is how does it happen that in some instances you find people coming up with pictures in the newspaper saying, look at this child, why is this seen? How does that happen? Because you should understand that these issues before us have been raised by such instances where there are things that are brought before us and demonstrated that you allow this to go on. That is one part of it. Secondly, all of them, they are in agreement that they have removed this, they don't show this. I always hear in the SABC an advert saying that if you have any problem with what is shown, you have to conduct and so forth and so forth and so forth. My question now is, in other words, they are saying, is there a right to do so at a certain time? ETV is saying that they no longer show any pornography until after 11 o'clock. So I'm saying, how does it happen that in some instances we are showing such things in the newspaper?
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me start with the section dealing with unconstitutionality of the bill. Chairperson, I am surprised by the legal advisor, the increase by the legal advisor. He has shown us the powers and the jurisdiction and the mandate they have as broadcasters, but it's not telling us about the mandate the department have, which was accorded by the Constitution to regulate where the broadcasting is failing to monitor. And another concern, Chairperson, if the multi-choice is saying they have a problem with compliance, and at the same time they are suggesting that the department must not regulate, I don't understand. Can they clarify us what should happen? Because as the state has the power to guide and protect the citizens, as accorded by our Constitution, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thanks, Jay. Thank you for the presentation. Yes, Jay, last night I think Advocate Hoffman reminded us of our duty as MPs to, you know, pass constitutional legislation. I've got just one worry, and maybe just for housekeeping purposes. We had today three, I think, examples of maybe possible non-constitutionality. Last night there were, I think, two or three clauses. It's not criticism against the department, but I think it will be valuable if we can get the chief state law advisor, sometime, not today or in the future, just to comment on those issues. Because it's important for us in dealing with legislation. You know, if there's six or seven pieces of the legislation that is prima facie unconstitutional, it creates a problem. So that we are able to deal with that. Then, just maybe one question on the presentation. In terms of examples, how many cases was brought to the self-regulatory institution, and how was that handled? Maybe just get feedback on that. But, Jay, I think it's very important that we should commit it yet. I mean,
that's the reason why I think the policy is not there. But for now, it's going to be good. And ask questions if there are questions, you know. But much work is going to be done by ourselves when we are looking and to get all these presentations. So now it's pushing for clarity and again, to make it fine. But much work is going to be done. at the committee level where we now meet with whoever that wants to come and also when we engage. We still invite them again to our sponsor to appear before the committee on many issues. But I think it's the point that they would have to see this institution, the unconditional issue, but that we know the constitution and looking at what the dean is saying is right. It's not something that we must share. And the constitutional court is there to guard against some of these things. So therefore, if we're to move in a particular direction and the bill is found unconstitutional, that's how the Constitutional Court, it will come back and rectify it. You know, I'm not saying that we must sort of insist because therefore we hear that everything is unconstitutional, therefore we must refuse. You know, we go forward by telling how we're going to go forward, taking into account the certain conclusion that we have. We will deal with that at a particular point in this question. Let me give one more together, and then from there we'll get a response on the issue.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I've got a problem or a worry about this blockage. And also the advertisement that shows that at such and such a time we'll be showing this and that. Here am I, an ordinary woman from a rural area. I'm in Cape Town. My children are alone there. And they see this advertisement. I'm not there. There's nobody to guide them to see that they don't follow or stay until that time to be able to see what is not for them to be seen. Why do we advertise? Why does ETV advertise to say during the day that such and such a time there's going to be this? Is it not encouraging these children because we know that our children are copycats? Why can't we stop advertising them? Thank you.
But again, if we do that, so we must look at the message that we have for no gratitude to the channel. At some point, maybe we'll deal with that in the committee without bringing in what you were saying. But look at this question and where it is. I understand the multi choice, but again, so I think you worry yourself about the content. You know, just consume something that we have dealt with this thing many years ago, and we still deal with this thing again today on the issues of the content. You know, which nobody worries about content. At some point, we will look at that. What worries us maybe is the content. You get this package, they're giving this package, you have this mechanism, but you don't know what is inside the content. So we left to what's called the medium content. Because our engagement will take us to not be a one-day thing. Because it's only ongoing, then obviously, until we get a solution on this problem, that is kind of the new development of technology, all of that, and it's a new challenge.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me add another question before they respond, Chairperson. I just want to make clarity from the presenters. When they say they are abide by the existing laws, but at the same time, they are saying broadcasters may only lower the classification under very specific circumstances. What does that mean? It means when it suits them, they will follow the law. When it doesn't suit them, they will just violate it.
Mr. Chick, can I begin by addressing some of the issues which relate to what I need to say, and they're at a general level, and then we'll go around the table and deal with some of the specific concerns. But I think the starting point, Mr. Chair, is that one has to recognise that what is broadcast on TV at the moment is permitted by two things. It's permitted by the existing legislation, and it's permitted by the Constitution. Because, Mr. Chair, the Constitution doesn't only protect expression that everyone in the country likes or that everyone in the country finds appropriate. The Constitutional Court has made explicit that the constitutional right to freedom of expression includes material that people don't like, that shocks, that is controversial. And the reason it does, Chair, is because we need to hear things that some people don't like because they might be right, because we need to hear the different views. Now, Mr. Chair, you know that, and you know that because of our history. So the point that we need to start with is the mere fact that some people are unhappy doesn't mean that things are unlawful, and it doesn't mean that they are against the Constitution. And so the starting point must be, and we've demonstrated it, that where complaints have gone to the BCCSA and where complaints have been brought in terms of legislation, those complaints have been upheld if they've been valid complaints. And the code of conduct that the BCCSA uses, Chair, is not something that the broadcasters developed by themselves. It's a code of conduct that was a schedule to the IBA Act, but the schedule has been put in place by Parliament. It's now been put in place in the forms of regulation by a council. But it's not a code of conduct that the people around this table approved of. It's a code of conduct that Parliament put in place in line with its constitutional mandate. And so if this committee is unhappy with what is screened on television, then the committee needs to consider two things. Does the existing legislation, the Electronic Communications Act, which regulates this, does that need to be changed? Because at the moment it permits it. But secondly, Chair, that's not the only question, because if the Constitution permits it, then this committee might need to recognise that the only way of doing it is to deal with amending the Constitution. And we're not suggesting that, Chair, but we need to be realistic. I put a table before this committee, Chair, which demonstrated the respects in which the bill restricts things that the Constitution doesn't. So there's no problem, Chair, with the theory that a statute prevents propaganda for war. Because the Constitution says propaganda for war doesn't constitute valid expression. So as long as you put the wording in correctly, as long as it's tight, as long as it's limited, that's fine. But where you're dealing with things that are not propaganda for war, that are not advocacy of hatred, and are not the incitement of imminent violence, in other words, things like sexual conduct, it does mean, Chair, that you're limiting a fundamental right. Not that you can never do it, but the Constitution at the moment accepts those things. And so I think that's just an important starting point. The broadcasters are complying with their statutory and constitutional obligations, and that's the first point. The second point to make is there was a question about what the Constitution says about the mandate of the department to regulate to step in when broadcasters don't comply. The first thing, yes, as I've demonstrated, the broadcasters are complying. They're complying with the Act and the Constitution, and no one suggests otherwise. What seems to be at the root of the unhappiness is that these things still get screened, but that's permitted. And you can't change it with respect, Chair, by putting in place this bill because of the constitutional difficulties that I've explained. If one wants to change it, the only way to do it would be by amending the ECA on the one hand and possibly by amending the Constitution, depending on how far you go. But the second thing, Chair, is that the Constitution, of course, gives government a mandate to deal with these issues, to respect, protect, promote, and fulfill all of the rights. But it also says something very specific about broadcasting. It says with regard to broadcasting, there must be an independent entity to regulate broadcasting. And that independent entity is ICASA. So this is different to the question of the print media, where the Constitution doesn't say who must regulate the print media. The Constitution does say who must regulate broadcasters, and that's ICASA. So if there's unhappiness about that, then it must be dealt with via those channels, via ICASA and via the ECA. It can't be dealt with by crafting on a separate provision, saying in addition to being subject to a cost, you're going to be subject to the Form of Publication Clause, because that raises these concerns. Thank you, Chair.
I'll deal with some of the issues that I think are especially easy, but I'm sure my colleagues will add on. The one question was, a question was raised about advertisements which are shown before a certain time, before the watershed. And state for the record, it is ETV's internal policy not to show that promos and advertisements are subject to exactly the same classification criteria as the movie. So if a movie is 18 rated and it can only be shown after 10 o'clock, then if a promo is also 18 rated, it can also only be shown after 10 o'clock. We don't content in our promos which would violate the watershed or the code of conduct in the event that was a movie that we were airing at that time. So we exercise as much caution with the content of our promos that we show before 10 o'clock as we do with the content of our movies. The other issue was the statistics of the DCCSA. I've just looked into their website now to see if those numbers are available. Unfortunately, they're not. They do confirm in the annual report. I think Johan will be able to deal with that question, so I'll leave that to him. The other issue was lowering classification in specific circumstances. I think, and I'm sure the SCB is also very mindful of this, that many of the classifications that were given to Form 1994 were in fact very much informed by the thinking of the day. And there were a range of reasons for particular classifications to be put in place which are no longer appropriate. So generally the classifications which broadcasters change, and I must say they are in very rare circumstances, relate to films that were classified before the current Film and Publications Board came into view. I can give you a very simple example of material that was regarded under the previous government as subversive and was therefore rated as 18, even though there was no content in the film that was offensive. That is something that we would re-look at and give it what we feel is a valid classification in the circumstances. I must just record here that we are severely punished by the DCCSA if we do not comply with the guidelines of the FPB, and if we do not show a very good reason for not complying with those guidelines. Generally, the DCCSA will find against the broadcaster if it has not complied by the guidelines, complied with the classification guidelines of the FPB.
Now we have your phone calls of from ETV, and we have this other calls of the broadcaster. So each one of you have their internal codes and the other codes. And the compliance, they need all these codes, on the codes, especially the main codes, the codes that guide you in this association.
There are two mechanisms in terms of which compliance is monitored. The one is obviously by means of complaints. Members of the public may lodge complaints, and the DCCSA then hears those complaints and pronounces on them. The other aspect is that we are required, I know ETV is required now, and I suspect my colleagues will confirm this, but to report to ECASA on an annual basis on our compliance with the code, and we are required to submit those written reports at the end of every single license year to explain to them the extent to which we have complied with the code.
In fact, in addition to the DCCSA code, the Electronic Communications Act also sets up a new complaint commission with ECASA, the one that Dr. Ken mentioned earlier, that it was sworn into office this past week. So there is also another body under the office of ECASA that also has got a jurisdiction over the activities of the broadcaster.
Jiyoung, maybe just to clarify that point further, to say that the body under ECASA would deal with all non-content related issues for members of the NAB. So the legislation recognizes the DCCSA as the self-regulatory body. For those broadcasters who are not a member of the NAB or a DCCSA, they would fall under the jurisdiction of the body within ECASA. And for our current members, all issues that are not related to content, in other words, issues that deal with license conditions, they've also fallen under the jurisdiction of ECASA and that body. So the DCCSA focuses only on the content issues, and it's specifically established to deal with content and compliance on content and compliance to content. In saying that, Chair, also I think it's noteworthy that the DCCSA is the single biggest advertiser on television and radio in South Africa. It gets more airtime than anyone else in terms of public awareness. Incidentally, the Advertising Standards Authority did an audience research 2-3 years ago to establish what their penetration is within the public, how well aware is the public of the Advertising Standards Authority. And the DCCSA came out as one single public body that's best known amongst the public, with a penetration of about 78% of the population.
So I think it's noteworthy to take into account the fact that the public awareness is there, people are aware of the BCCFA. And as a result of that, we heard the ombudsman reporting that they get a couple of hundreds of complaints a year. The BCCFA gets 3,000 complaints a year. Or last year they handled over 3,000 complaints. 125 of those dealt with adult content, which is roughly 4.5% of all the complaints dealt with. Of those 125, about 122 were disqualified because they did not have specific complaints or did not relate to specific item or issue. Three of those complaints actually went further for investigation. Four of those complaints were further investigated. The one against ECD was dismissed, and then there were three against 5SM that were upheld. Just one case with three complaints. So that gives you an indication. In 2005, we had 50 complaints on adult content. In 2004, 26. In 2003, 3 complaints. And just thus far this year, we've had 25 complaints on adult content out of just over 1,000 complaints. So the penetration is big, there's a lot of complaints coming through, but relative to the volume of complaints that the BCCFA deals with, the issue of adult content is not a major, does not take up a proportionate high amount of time.
The main question is,
you know,
of the guidelines that
BCCFA
has how do you relate to the civil competition? Do you relate somehow? Do you have any, maybe not a
Thank you. As my colleagues have mentioned before, that most broadcasters rely on the NAB guidelines and are required to do so in terms of our code. Through the NAB, we have in fact engaged with the Format Publication Board around the issues of classification and primarily alignment classification, and they wanted to engage with us as broadcasters to deal with issues around communicating classification guidelines to our viewers and our subscribers, and that engagement is ongoing, as I understand. We're looking at ways in which we can assist the board with communicating classification guidelines to the public. That's really the issue that we're engaging with.
Nobody has ever lost the license because of the
customer.
Not yet, because the license... No. I'm just saying, nobody's ever lost
the license. But the provision is there for that kind of default. And then also in terms of lowering the FPV restrictions, in our case with the SABC, the same principle applies for previously rated or classified materials, very often. But with newer materials, we will never go below an FPV restriction. And in terms of your query about engagement, yes, we do engage with the FPV sometimes when our schedulers feel when they need to discuss things with them, they do. They easily And we also engage in that process. When we started the campaign I mentioned earlier about informing people about Google, we actually approached the FPV at the time to do it as a joint process.
So, if the idea happens that we can work with the human publication, Absolutely, we can work here.
Yes.
Even if we are independent, we can work with them.
We do work.
We agree.
We do it.
And just the last one.
The other reason why I'm asking this question is we do it in the committee.
I think we need to reaffirm what many of us have said. We have no reason not to work with the SDB. It's just a principle that we'll try to get for now. And just the last one here, if I might. Advertising, which you referred to, I think anybody mentioned this. Like the BCCSA regulates content, there's also the Advertising Standards Authority which regulates advertising. And it's broadcast that we abide by a code there. And in terms of our own FEBC editorial policies, I need to point this out, that there's public broadcast, that some of the policies that we have are often even stronger in terms of content than the actual code. So for example, we can also show, technically, the code allows us to show pornography after 11 at night, but in our editorial policies, which is a conscious decision that we will not. So there are many measures in our editorial policies which are even stronger than the code.
They now give you this advertising but to make this phone number. Because it's you and cell phones now who are together, connecting in your phone. Would you cell phones later? Just you know, firstly I know. Because when I engage with you individually, I'd be talking to a number of you. People will say, you know what, that's where we make a lot of money. If you touch that one, you touch on that. Now, firstly, the content of that I, many of them, which has been even the newspapers are part of. Newspapers, television, cell phones, these numbers where they advertise. In fact, television advertised them and the radio newspapers advertise them. And then cell phone users then dial the number to get the message they want. Now there is the nudity, pornography, and all of this. Right? How was, just tell me the relationship of doing the content of those people and how do they register to you? Assuming that you don't help them. They're shaking you in. But ETV, I know, and ETV, in fact, do them more. I think that's where they generate more money than anything else. Now, can we, don't say eternally, just raising it. And you, in fact, as much as you can show phonograph, but it has a lot of this number.
I'd be very glad to hear where they are because I'd like to just
let
somebody put their phone.
So you don't do the
phone
number?
We don't do the cell
phone
number
okay.
Advertisement for the
phone. Okay. Picture. So it's only ETV that does them. ETV, share with us the experiences there and how you give the content of these people who take their numbers. Who is in charge of these numbers?
We have a person in our commercial finance department who checks every single commercial who is submitted, not only checks the commercial, also dials into the number and checks the content that is provided on that service. We have refused many of those advertisements. We will continue to do so. We set up our own internal code of conduct regarding the acceptance of those advertisements, which has been communicated to all advertisers. So we don't only just look at the content of the advertisement, although often we do reject the advertisement merely on the face of the content of the commercial itself. We also look into the services behind the commercial, and we will not accept any commercial from anyone who's not a member of WhatsApp. So there are several layers of codes of conduct that have to be followed before such a commercial is accepted on the
Chairman, if I can just answer the question relating to multi-choice and the issue of non-compliance as submitted in the presentation. I think multi-choice would like to reiterate that it is not trying to evade regulation, it is open to regulation. What it is saying is that it is presently regulated. It is presently subject to both the regulatory and legislative framework of the ECA. It is subject to regulation by the CASA. It is subject to the legislative framework of the present Film and Publications Bill, and insofar as the EC Act permits, it is subject to the BCC SA Codes of Conduct and the Subscription Codes of Conduct. So, multi-choice is not saying that because it's unable to comply with the
propose amendments to the bill that it should not be regulated, except regulation. But what is it saying is that it is presently regulated, and it is saying that there is a self-regulation system in place which is working very efficiently and is very effective, and that dispensation should remain in place.
This a regulated system is talking about, so many bodies that regulate man's choice. But the problem with man's choice is that they don't deal with conduct. Therefore, what informs this so many a bodies that they sort of regulate and you abide by those, but you don't deal with conduct. You receive the blockers, but why this body is not look at SABC and the ETV? There's so many bodies that you really, in fact, I really appreciate, you know, the manner in which you appreciate the regulators. You know, I really appreciate that fact. But these two organizations, which is ETV and SABC, it's only two that are here. Ourselves, then coming themselves, and the, what's called this association, the Denver. Why they're not celebrating like you do with passion and, you know, that positive energy that, you know, we proud ourselves because this is what we do, but at the same time, the content, we don't even touch the content of what we provide today to the public. In the association, do you discuss these things together? Do you discuss these things? You're part of what we understand, okay, it will be, I mean, there will be standards where members of the association need look at the regulations, look at the code of conduct and all of that. And then I think, I want to understand now this marriage again, that it's a marriage that works. If it works, therefore, would have engaged around this.
I think when it comes to multi-choice or Centec or any other multi-channel service provider, I think you need to recognize that there's channels that are coming in from other territories. Multi-choice generally, there is no control over the CNNs and the BBC. But there are also channels that are originated within South Africa. And as far as those are concerned, the subscription code is very specific as to what content, how content should be regulated when it's originated within South Africa and those that are originated externally. And in that context, that multi-choice, in some of its channels, we have difficulty in regulating it, and when I say us, I mean the DCC is able to cover. And in other channels, certainly they are controlled over and they have editorial policies in place to deal with those in line with the code.
Just to add to that, Chair, at multi-choice, you know, with the international channels, we have contracts with each and every channel, and we demand that they give us proof, you know, that they are subject to the prevailing regulatory codes and legislation in their country of origin. And we engage with our suppliers on an ongoing basis. If the content is seen to be unacceptable in our environment in South Africa, we go back to them. And we have cases where there are channels that are tailored for our market, which may be just South Africa or the continent of Africa, which often tends to be more conservative anyway. So I think we are not, apathetic. We're not standing there and saying we don't have any interest over content. We engage with all our channel suppliers to ensure that the content is acceptable in terms of our existing legislation. Thank you.
Chair, I just want to direct this question to the advocate who has said his admiration of the intentions the committee is trying to achieve. But he went further to say the problem with the present amendment bill is that it goes too far. So it would help. I would like to hear his comments because it will help us during our deliberation as a committee as to say how far, what is
that you say we are going too far on. And the committee is aware, there has been, we have dealt with this some years back, where there was a court ruling which expressed the rights of the broadcasters to say, if I don't like it, there are people who like that, we're quite cautious about that. So we can't stop that, the ruling stands. But you are saying, you recognize the good intentions, but it goes too far. What do you suggest? How far should we go? Where do we stop?
Thank you, Chair. In one of the documents from the presenter, Chairperson, in November 2005, ICASA conducted a roundtable discussion with FPP. They have some recommendations. One of the recommendations, they need for a uniform content classification. Number two, public awareness of the DCCSA and the watershed period. Number three, user-friendly complaint system. I just want to find how far have you gone. Secondly, have you informed those who fall under your jurisdiction about your agreement with the FPP?
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to follow up on what Comrade Cake just said with regard to the advocate, the quoting Section 192 of our Constitution regarding the independency of the broadcasting authority. The concern I wanted to raise is that the Constitution states it clearly that The national legislation must establish an independent authority to regulate broadcasting in the public interest and to ensure fairness and diversity. Now, here we are, like Kate said, that we are sharing two diverse views. How can we bring the two diverse views, you know, to a balance? Because the public is in support of the bill, and this side the broadcasters feel that we are encroaching on the independency of the broadcasting authority. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. If I can respond to those two questions together, let me perhaps begin with the first. Now, the first was, how far can the bill legitimately go in terms of the Constitution? Where should it stop? And I think in order to answer that question, we need to separate two questions. The one is, which body should have jurisdiction over broadcasters? And the other is, whichever body has jurisdiction, what should the content restrictions be? Because I think you've got to keep those two separate questions separate. With regard to the question of jurisdiction, which body is to have jurisdiction over broadcasters? The answer is a simple, black and white one. The only body that can have jurisdiction over broadcasters is ICASA, in terms of the Constitution. So it's not a question of how far you can go, can you give the Film and Publication Board some jurisdiction over broadcasters. In terms of the Constitution, the only body that can have jurisdiction is ICASA, not the Film and Publication Board. But it's on the content side, the second side, that we get more complicated. If you were to, say, put in restrictions, but let the restrictions be administered by ICASA, then the question is, how far can you go? Which restrictions can you put in? And the clear restrictions that you can put in are those specified in Section 16, sub 2 of the Constitution. The Constitution says everyone has the right to freedom of expression, but there are three kinds of expression that there's no right to. Propaganda for war, the incitement of imminent violence, and the advocacy of hatred based on specified grounds, which constitutes incitement to cause imminent harm. Those three limitations on freedom of speech, if this committee were to say a broadcaster shall not broadcast A, B, and C, there would be no difficulty, no constitutional difficulty. But it's when you go beyond those two,
It's when you add in things, the others that I put in the table, the sexual conduct, the other, or if you say, whenever you say something hatred, whenever you go beyond those three, then suddenly there are potential constitutional difficulties, because then you are limiting the right. So in my answer, how far can you safely go? My answer would be limit to the three types of speech set out in section 16.2 of the Constitution. That's how far I would suggest that you go. And with regard to the second question, the learned member is absolutely correct. The legislation must ensure a diversity of views. But diversity of views means a diversity of views of the viewing public. There are some members of the viewing public who want certain types of content. There are some people who don't. And so the legislation needs to make sure that content is available for lots of people, provided that it's not things in section 16.2, propaganda for war, incitement of imminent violence, etc. So there does need to be a diversity of views, but the diversity of views needs to cater to the different people, and those who don't want to watch need not do so. That's the point, is that where you cater to a diversity of views, the people who don't like what's streamed, who don't want to, must turn off, and they won't watch, and the channels will suffer, and that's the way it will be dealt with. But the second point, Namik, if the legislature is going to deal with the diversity of views and try to change the legislation to do it, they can, as I say, only do it under the auspices of ICASA, because you can't do it under the auspices of the Film and Publications Board because of the constitutional difficulties that I've set up. And there, as I've said, there's no middle ground. It's either ICASA or it's likely to be unconstitutional. I hope that's answered the question, Chair.
All right.
Chairperson, I would follow up to the advocate, because according to the documents that they submitted to us, they are complaining about the withdrawal of exemption, which licensed broadcasters, section 23(3) in brackets. They are not saying it's unconstitutional when they have the exemption. But when we withdraw the exemption, they say it's unconstitutional. What is your view? Yes.
Come on, that one. That's just coming to that. We'll engage with the target some point. Because currently we have to deal with the role of the film and publication. We deal with content and the role of the target with the film. We'll deal with that. We'll clarify the things at some point. For the purpose of engagement, now let us engage with the great people. We'll meet again ourselves and look at why would the state, parliament, pass the law to regulate films and publishing. Since from 1996, this law has been in place. It's only now that we have to deal with this conversation when we have to deal with the issue of regulating the music from the issue of publication. It goes back to the core. What was the intention then? But we've engaged with the task, I think, not to change around this issue. But again, it's a body that has been established. I don't want us to engage with them to a point that does not have answers. But politically, I think at parliament level, we still have a ground to engage with other committees and other ministries that are responsible for certain of the work that has been done by each other in particular communication. Let's engage around issues that are creating some kind of problem. Because here, film and publication has been given a mandate. It's a very clear mandate. And it has been given a mandate to deal with the broadcasting licensing. And here is the situation. When now, film and publication has been given a content in broadcasting, and the whole thing now comes back to say, no, interesting, it's not that it's only cover. But we are self-regulated, so therefore, you know, we decide what is the content, not the culture at the same time. So we have to look at this change and try to really work one round thing rather than looking at the same. It's not a huge challenge. But I saw that there's the other question that we could be asked you. And then to respond, I think you can initiate an answer to my general comment. It's what I'm observing so far. Yeah, we look at the Constitution, we look at the Civil Constitution, we look at the Charter of the World and all of that. and the new developments that are coming up, you know, they must connect in whatever that communication is bringing, it must be able to link with what other people of legislation are doing. Okay. So that, you know, we don't have a situation where we have a bill that deals with this guy or a bill that deals with this guy. As I was saying to you earlier, that issues of communication and competition currently dealt with by the citizen competition. So we'll have to do that. The new challenge that the members of the committee will focus on.
Thank you, Chair. If I could deal with the first question, and I'm sorry if it's not clear, let me try and restate it. The Act as it stands says that all films in any form must be submitted for prior approval by the Film and Publications Board before they are distributed, broadcast, etc. But the Act then contains an exemption in Section 23, sub 2. And that exemption says, we know the rest of the Act says that you've got to submit it in every case, but for a licensed broadcaster, you need not submit your films. And so that's why we're in favor of the exemption. Because what the exemption says is all films must be submitted. If you're a Circinical or New Metro, you must always submit it. But if you're a licensed broadcaster, like the ones around this table, and you're bound by the other things, the other codes of conduct and the other legislation, you do not need to submit those provisions, those films. And that's why the current Act respects the Constitution, because it says everyone has to submit their films except people who are licensed broadcasters. And why does it do that? Because the Constitution and the Electronic Communications Act and its predecessors, those acts all say licensed broadcasters are subject to ICASA. So we're not going to make you subject to the Film and Publications Board as well. We're going to leave you to ICASA. So that's the reason that the exemption is sensible. If the exemption is removed, as proposed by the bill, then suddenly all licensed broadcasters are subject to every provision of this Act, including the classification provision. And that means, although they're still subject to ICASA under the Constitution and the ECA, they are also subject to the Film and Publications Board. And that's what gives rise to the constitutional difficulty. That's why the exemption as it stands complies with the Constitution. But removing the exemption would cause a constitutional problem. But can I, in developing that, just deal with your comments here? Because I wouldn't want to leave this committee with the misapprehension that ICASA doesn't deal with content. ICASA does deal with content, and it does so because legislation requires it to do so. The Electronic Communications, let's go back, the Independent Broadcasting Authority Act, before the ECA, that act contained as a schedule a code of conduct for broadcasters. That code of conduct dealt with content, and that act required the IBA, the predecessor of ICASA, to deal with content. The new act, the Electronic Communications Act, says ICASA must make regulations on a code of conduct, and again that code of conduct deals with content. And the new act goes further. The new act requires the class to put in place license conditions regarding local content, language quotas, all sorts of issues. The new act requires a range of content issues to be dealt with. And so the way the legislature has conceived of it up to now is that it can't deal with all the regulation of broadcasting, including content. And the Film and Publications Board deals with all the regulation of content except for broadcasters. And that's the way that the act has... That's the way the legislature has so far created the perfect harmony. That ICASA deals with everything with broadcasters, including content, and the FTD deals with all content except broadcasters. The problem is that the current Act changes that and undermines that. And that's what gives rise to the difficulty. Because then it will be two different... What is one to do? If ICASA says, we approve this, it does not violate the Code of Conduct. But at the same time, the Film and Publications Board is saying, no, we're not approving this for publication. That's the difficulty, Chair, is there would be two issues of content.
May I just raise the issue relating to Section 27, the offence, possession of certain publications and films, relating in particular to child porn.
What would be your view if both publications and films were to do this under that same provision in terms of Section 27? The exemption says as far as classification is concerned, but purely there is an exclusion on the same provision. make it an offence to distribute child pornography films and publications. That is what the bill is seeking to address. And I'm not sure if there's any other improvement there. Any other action I would think if that is done for me. What is your view on that? And the constitutionality of the system. Thank you.
After yesterday's discussion, I went to the question of the position of the child. One needs to think between broadcasters on the one hand and newspapers on the other. So this is then absolutely correct. For newspapers, they are not subject to Section 27, because the essential provision that newspapers have said is to a registered newspaper as a member of the newspaper union, you are not subject to that. But in fact, and I hadn't realized this yesterday, in fact, the position for broadcasters is different. If one has a look at Section 23, sub-2 of the Act, which provides, I must read it for you, and give you an important point, and see if I can get it first. Persons who get to receive the holder of a broadcasting license in terms of the IDA Act shall be exempt from the duty to apply for the classification of a film, and shall, subject to Section 24, shall in relation to the exhibition of a film
not be subject to any classification made by the board or any condition imposed by the board. So whereas for newspapers, there's a complete out from the Act, for broadcasters there's a much more limited exemption. It's only in respect of classification. And so therefore, that's why we've made the submission in our presentation, and we stand by that submission, and I stand by the legal advice that underlies it, is that if one of these broadcasters was to broadcast child pornography this afternoon, they would be committing a criminal offence, liable to up to 5 years of imprisonment. And I can't see any constitutional problem with that, and while I can't speak for newspapers, I can't see any constitutional problem with making newspapers liable to that either. Because all you're doing is about child pornography. It's not going into the core values of speech. And the Constitutional Court has made that clear. Child pornography does not amount to the core kind of speech that we protect. And that's why child pornography must stand on a different footing to other kinds of speech, including pornography. The Court has said pornography is in a different area, but child pornography is something that this committee can feel very content from a constitutional perspective in prohibiting, provided it's done very narrowly and restricted to child pornography. I hope that answers the question.
Therefore, we want to thank you very much for the wonderful engagement we had with you this morning. You see, what you must do, broken first, don't pay your lawyer before you analyze the deal. Because that coming to it. But we really want to thank you very much for this engagement. It's been wonderful, and I think the manner in which you are presenting, I think it sort of brought a lot of ideas to us, and therefore we'll have to look at all the issues that you've raised. I will take everything into account as well. And once we wish you were interested in your work and making money outside there, but at the same time to encourage you to really come up with mechanisms to deal with the problems that we are raising. As much as a multi-choice has demonstrated today that they're getting somewhere. And then we'll help the public broker fund. In fact, you are more responsible to have than anybody else to make sure that you don't get there. We find yourself there. ETV, one that started a wonderful vision for the human students. There's this unnecessary thing of pornography with the community, and I think it's not right. We should sort of try and work together very closely. If you lock yourself in a corner, then you keep on hammering at ETV. And it's not nice for a particular broadcaster to be hammered most of the time by the parliament and the party. So I think it's very important that let's develop a way of working together and trying to address some of the challenges. On that note, I want to thank you very much. And we'll see you outside there. And so let's see. And then we can have a break for about the 5 minutes.
Okay. I think it's a good question for today. Volumes and it's falling apart, this thing.
Thank you.
Therefore, the issues are before you. I think I see that you have a student issue already in 32 years. And I believe that members are in position of the student issue. Therefore, without waiting for the student, we'll allow you to come to the point of introducing yourself. It's a normal way of public hearing, we started this hearing sometime last year.
I'd like to introduce the team from the mobile operators who will assist me in answering any questions that you might have. They are Graham DeFries on my left, and Regina Newman from MTN, and on my right is Fiona Manson from C, Palamide Pongwan, and Ichimiling Mueran. The mobile operator submission is aligned with their earlier joint written submission, and we'll see them slide by slide. Okay. Handout that you've been given, hopefully the IG system will come back and you'll be able to see it on screen. But if you look at the handout, starting on the third page of the presentation, our presentation is structured in two parts. Part A deals with general comments on the bill, and Part B, the more specific comments. As the content provision of a mobile rule address, the content value chain, the challenges mobile operators meet in addressing the content value chain. Secondly, with regard to regulation, the options in respect of regulation, and thirdly, the operator's code of good practice. It's all highlighted in black in the presentations before you. In respect of the operator's code of good practice, we'll speak to the background and time frames of negotiations in that regard, its alignment with international best practice, and the key commitments made by the operator. And I'll say a question of in terms of the code. Lastly, the WhatsApp code of conduct, its support, and its monitoring by the sender operators, and how the operator's code of good practice enforces the WhatsApp code. If you look at page 5 of the handout, which speaks to the content of mobile networks, in our submission, we noted that there are a variety of means by which any content can be accessed by a mobile subscriber. For example, they through a content portal of a mobile operator, and these are advertised MTN loaded, Vodafone Live, or CelTV. By means of third-party content providers, which is by agreement of the mobile operator concerned, via the internet and through peer-to-peer communication. And by TSG communications, we mean content that can be accessed on an individual basis by an SMS or MMS. Okay. Content generally can be requested and delivered via a whole variety of bearers that are available to the mobile network. And these are commonly known as SMS, IVR, WAP, WIG, USSD, and MMS. The most commonly used is, of course, SMS, and followed in terms of popularity by MMS. If you want the breakdown of the acronyms, we can provide that later on. The content that is available can be requested on one bearer, that is, let's say, by SMS, the short message system, and delivered via WAP, which is wireless access protocol. So, you know, there is interaction between the platforms that are available for you. This presentation will address these means and the entities in an effort to explain the complexity involved in accessing mobile content and in laying out the value chain. On the next slide, we speak to the stakeholders in this value chain. Entities can be loosely classified as content creators, the content distributors, the internet service providers, the website owners, and the wireless application service providers for web. There also, in addition, a group known as the third-party content aggregators, which are really watched with their own infrastructure for aggregating the content of other ones. Portals, which may be operated by either mobile operators or other parties, network operators, and finally the consumers themselves. These entities can loosely be classified as all the above-mentioned parties who play a role in the development, advertising, and delivery of services, of which other content is but a portion of services available to the consuming public. On the next page, we seek specifically to areas where the mobile operators do not exercise any control over content that's delivered over their network. The first is the internet. As you all know, the internet is an open network. It's not an operator business, nor is it an operator business. It is inherently the ultimate open network. Any destination is an accessible IP address. Therefore, the mobile operators do not have any control of content accessed by the subscribers via the internet. It is ultimately responsible of the person whom the communication is distant to secure this content. And in accessing this content, the united balance between civil liberties and consumer protection must be managed and protected. When you speak to peer-to-peer communication, and this is entirely subscriber-driven communication, this is amounts to direct communication to individuals via SMS or MMS. And operators may not accept or intercept communications in terms of the Constitution and privacy legislation that takes place between peers. And in terms of the law itself, interception is either managed in terms of the Regulation of Interception of Communications Act. Mobile operators do not have control over the actions of WAP. Their relationship with the WAP are determined by contracts and is based on the use of numbers issued by ICASA to the mobile specifically for the use of WAP, and in turn the use of the mobile network by the WAP themselves. Bearing this in mind, the mobile operators have taken a number of self-regulating steps to speak to the value chain in which they engage in. And if you look at the slide that speaks to this, the value chain really, as spoken to earlier, starts from content creation to distribution to content aggregation and display in a portal, and then to accessing such content by a consumer using a network owned by an operator. With respect to the option for regulation of what content delivered to mobile handsets, we are faced with three scenarios. The first speaks to formal regulation. In respect of formal regulation, there's little or no flexibility in terms of its implementation. And it has proved difficult to keep track of developments in the fast-moving telecommunications market. However, formal regulation can act as a platform for action against abuse by external parties over which operators have no control. In this respect, delivery of spam over their networks and the people who are responsible for such spam, but does not negate the right to include self-regulatory mechanisms. And these, in addition, formal regulation takes the form of the ECC and the ECS, and also the Films and Publications Act. The space in which the mobile operators are engaged in is what's known as the cooperative self-regulation sphere. In this sphere, we believe we're in a position to be flexible, to keep track of developments in the market as it unfolds, and also to make use of mechanisms that are already in place. For the mobile operators, it's the preferred option as far as it's reasonably possible and practical, and also constitutes the common commitment to development of the market in a way that will meet customers and other stakeholder concerns. The way this has been done has been through an industry representative body code, the IRB code, through the WASP code of conduct, and through the WASP MOU. I'll first speak to the code, the IRB code. The IRB code arises out of the Electronic Communications Act of Section 5 of 2002. In Chapter 11, there's provision for the limitation of liability for service providers who act as conduits of content. The Act specifically identifies the mobile operator as the conduit of content and not as a generator of content. And in this regard, a code of good practice was signed by mobile operators and became effective on 2 November 2005. However, what is emphasized is that mobile operators are to resubmit to the minister updated code in light of recently published guidelines for IRB codes, which the minister made available last year. As the key provisions of the IRB code for mobile operators, they intended to facilitate compliance by WASP to WASP code of conduct and the WASP advertising guidelines. They introduced procedures to receive and respond to takedown notifications in terms of content made available by WASP. They placed an obligation on WASP not to place advertisements depicting explicit sexual content and ensure that such advertisements are not placed in the general media. They also introduced measures to prevent access by children to adult content, and also incorporated an undertaking by the WASP not to introduce spam to the network itself. The second cooperative regulatory code that is in place constitutes the WASP Code of Conduct. MTN and SLC mandate membership to WASP of all wireless application service providers. Vodacom in turn contractually mandates compliance with the WASP Code of Conduct, advertising guidelines, and the compliance resolution procedure. So mobile operators have since inception contributed to WASP's operating expenses and will do so until it is self-sustaining. The mobile operators require WASP to use a separate number range for the provision of content of an adult or sensitive nature, and the WASP has 6 months until September 2007 to migrate all content of an adult and sensitive nature to a separate number range that will be made known to the public at large. In return, the operators have agreed to educate consumers regarding the nature of content provided by the separate number range. I'll now move on to Part B, which really seeks to comment on some pertinent specific provisions of the amending legislation. Section 1, in respect thereof, the definition of child abuse, in addition to the definition of internet service provider, and thirdly to the definition of chat room. In Section 2, to the references to broadcasting and mobile handsets, the inclusion of a classification office and compliance officers, the classification of all content, the exemption of certain material, the business of adult premises, and internet access. With regard to Section 24C1, the definition of internet service provider, our concern is that the distinction between internet service provider and mobile operator is not apparent, despite all prior legislation in this regard, which recognizes the distinction between the two, and also the failure to distinguish between providing a chatroom service as opposed to hosting a website. Our recommendation in that regard is that this distinction be highlighted and be made substantially clearer. In that regard, we would argue that in 24C1, service providers shall refer to those who provide child-oriented services, including chat rooms, etc., and in that respect, they shall be bound to the provisions of 24C1. As to the definition of chat room, our concern is that the requirements to monitor a chat room service should be placed on a chat room moderator, that is, on the providers of the service itself, that it should take cognizance of the right to customer privacy, that it should recognize the inability of the mobile operators to monitor a chat room, however it's constituted, and should be able to recognize that a chat room is really a real-time service as between customers over which we have little or no control. Further, that with regard to SMS and MMS interaction or discussion, is that these constitute peer-to-peer private communication and that such privacy may not be infringed. To that end, we recommend that the definition be reworded to read chatroom means a worldwide web site in which people hold discussions by sending messages to people on the same site in real time, both in a general sense and on a peer-to-peer basis. Then move on to Section 2A, and it's a reference to broadcasting. Our concern is that the reference as it currently stands, constitutes contravention of Section 192 of the Republic of the Constitution, Act Number 108 of 1996, and it also may operate in a manner which does not address other regulations which address age inappropriate broadcast. In that regard, we want to refer you to the Electronic Communications Act of 2005, the Broadcasters Code of Conduct, the WhatsApp Code of Conduct, and the Advertising Standards Authority Guidelines. Our recommendation in that regard is that the reference to broadcasting should be deleted from Section 2A. Again, in Section 2A, it's a reference mobile handsets. Our concern is that if mobile handsets are mentioned and the distinction is not properly drawn, how does regulation then apply to computers, television, and printed media, or any other feature forms of content provision or content display in our context? Again, there also is a failure to address regulation with respect to the internet, and would much rather argue for a technology user approach as is advocated and set out in the ECA Act. Our recommendation is that the deletion to the reference to Hansard, as it is not content category and really constitutes a display mode, and that the legislation should, as far as possible, be technologically neutral. As to Section 9 of the Act, the Classification Office, the concern there is that given the approach to content regulation, the office would probably face a capacity constraint if all content was declassified. We already had debroadcasters speak to the whole range of issues that content classification raises in a range of contexts, but we will not go there. We just need to raise that issue. And also, the time frames for classification, submission, and approval are not addressed. In response, we recommend that quick time frames for classification must be stated, adhered to, and also made known. And we support the regulation approach that seeks to co-regulation to alleviate capacity constraints, and also one that addresses concerns raised earlier by the print and broadcast media. As to Section 18, the registration of films and games, our concern is that with respect to the approach taken, that it will hamper innovation. It'll delay time to market of material, which is vital to the success of mobile content service provision. It introduces constraints to time classification and delivery to market. And again, it is so all-embracing that the capacity of service delivery is called seriously in question. Our recommendation in respect thereof, that is with regard to Section 2.1, is that there be strict time frames for classification. We would support an approach of co-regulation once more to alleviate capacity constraints, and propose that not only that the process in accordance with all existing law, but that all self-regulatory bodies that deal with such matters are engaged in its work. As to Section 23, which seeks the exemption, again, we don't want to paraphrase the previous submission by the broadcasters, but simply to highlight the board's discretion is very limited in terms of Section 22, and that there are fundamental limitations and controls on the exercise of discretionary power, and that the exemption also does not apply to publications. Our recommendation in this regard is that the board's discretion in respect of the grant of an exemption should be extended, and that the legislation should take into account other materials such as publications, mobile broadcast publications, interactive media. As to Section 24, read of Section 15A, the business of adult premises. Our concern is that it is impossible in the current context for mobile content providers to comply with these provisions or apply for licensing. Currently, regulations only provide for licensing of businesses operating from physical locations. Our recommendation is respected that Section 24.1 be extended to include the licensing of virtual private operators, such as WASP, operating from virtual premises. That a new Section 24 be inserted to set out the definitions of virtual adult content, virtual premise, and mobile content services. And that in this respect, we alert you to the fact that we have provided some indicative wording in our written submission. As to Section 24C, Internet Access and Service Provider, our concern is that cities of access via cellular technology, either GPRS, Edge, or 3G various services is not really addressed, or acknowledge or even contextualize that ISPs are internet access providers, they're not content providers, and our relationship with them differs from our relationship with a body such as WhatsApp, that the mobile operator's role and function is essentially that of access provider and not of content provider, and that really does not seem to be acknowledged, that offenders are unknown until the crime is committed, and this is not really clear from Section 24C1A, and that the application of 24C1B is not practical with respect to mobile phones and services. Again, we've alerted to the practicality of age classification in the mobile environment and the capacity for the enforcement, and further that there's no ubiquitous filtering software that is available to filter or block pornographic material, and that the filtering and blocking is fundamentally not the function of the mobile operator, and we've also alleged to the ECTA and our recommendation in this respect is that the classification in the mobile environment should be limited simply to identification of restricted or unrestricted content in line with the numbering arrangements that would seek to access the site, and that the obligation to be extended to allow for the implementation of alternative control solutions, which are device agnostic or network block based solutions, as would allow for the blocking or filtering of pornographic content. In conclusion, we would like to alert the committee to our concern with respect to not only the jurisdictional conflict as to when and which legislation applies with respect to what is laid before us, but all the effect of concurrent jurisdiction in terms of different legislation, and other provisions of the Electronic Communications Act, which seek many of these issues. Our recommendation in this regard is that agreement be sought between different regulatory bodies on issues of concurrent jurisdiction, that a certain hierarchy in terms of applicable law is addressed, and a distinction drawn between applicable law. Operators in the main support cooperative self-regulatory framework. We believe it, given time, will be able to address most of the issues that have been put before the mobile operators of issues of concern. We pledge our support first aimed at dealing with these issues, we however wish to alert to the fact that we can only deal with addressing this issue in the context of having the necessary technological tools, and there must be some acknowledgement of the process at which these tools are put into place. And we'd like to alert all parties that issues of access and content is one in which the role of parents and of all accessors, all parties who access such content, remains critical, irreplaceable, and must be addressed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Obviously, this is some kind of direct recommendation from the amendment, some of the problems that we have. That's why I think that the member of the committee is that we have this discussion for you. Yes, what's your name? Did I call you for this?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks for the confidence. I just want to ask, maybe in the presentation it indicated that there's a proposal that the existing self-regulatory bodies and other bodies such as the IRB work with the Phone Intoxication Board, and the original submission in October last year, you also said instead of two separate parallel processes, you should work on some form of co-regulatory framework to be established. What I can't understand is that the cell or the mobile phone industry has been around for a long time. Why must you, wait until the legislature comes with some initiatives before you come to the table with such an approach? And what is exactly that framework you've got in mind?
terms of child regulation. Can you maybe indicate us what is your plan? Thank you, Chairperson. My third question, Chairperson, I just want to find out from the presenter. Because here he's saying operator's code of good practice. Who is monitoring the operation of code of good practice? My second question, Chairperson, here the presenter is saying that alignment with international best practice. I just want to know when are they going to have alignment with the new amendment? My last question, Chairperson, in relation with Film and Publication Act, Industries Representative Body, called IRB. Also here, Chairperson, who is monitoring the compliance? Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for your presentation, and clearly the concern of civil society and members of the committee is the downloading by children of pornography on their cell phones. We all are aware of that. And we need to, and whilst you have dealt with it to a degree in your submission, and yesterday we heard from WASPA the various that they should rather do it at a top level, but what are the steps that one can take further in that? What are the implications for us should we try to have the software downloaded onto a cell phone? I don't understand all the technology, but we clearly, that is the concern, that is what our constituents are saying. We've got to find a way to stop children at school downloading the pornography. That's the simple issue. If you can try to, and I've probably been canvassed very technologically, but where is the best way, what is the best way of doing that? If you could just help us to understand the technological aspects of that. Thank you.
So, thanks, Chief. Just maybe another question. In terms of the revenue generated by these three companies, you know, it's all cash back. I just want to know, in terms of your spend, you've indicated in your last slide, at the end of the day, the responsibility to the parent or the adult. What do you do in terms of informing your target audience in terms of in terms of education? One of your firms sent monthly a booklet, a glossy one that one must pay for as well, I think 24 rand. What do you do to promote this important thing to bring it under attention of your subscribers?
Then we'll take the next round of questions.
Thank you. I'll ask my colleague to respond to these.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll respond to a few of the questions. When it comes to existing self-regulation bodies working with the FTD. That's what is intended. These bodies were formed at the stage where this amendment was also taking place. And as a result, we're putting this code of conduct because the issue of wireless application service providers and provision of content of a mobile is a relatively new phenomenon. If you would remember that, for instance, from the inception of mobile, the type of handsets that were there were not capable of providing internet access, were capable of providing certain services, but that has evolved over time. And as a result of that, we have to look at instruments that could be put in place in order to address that. Now, there is a number of measures that have been put by different operators to try and address the different issues that confront parents in terms of children accessing content. Now, I want to get specifically into practical things that have been done. The type of handsets that are there, there's a balance that is being struck between low-cost handsets and more advanced handsets that have got certain capabilities, and in those handsets you can actually load the type of software that can, on one hand, once it allows you to access newer and newer type of services, it also enables you to have certain functionality that prohibits certain things to keep on happening. Now, if for instance you take Vodacom as an institution, I'm sure MTN and Cell C will also indicate that. Already what the statistics I got when just asking was that there's already about 200,000 phones that are blocked by parents for their children from accessing this type of content. And it's a simple procedure that parents can use in order to block that content. But the system that is there at the present moment is the one of opting out. Meaning that you can, with the type of phones that are there, actually access this content. But parents can put that system in place, I mean, dial *111*123#. In the process, it actually locks the child's phone in accessing content. Now, the system that is being developed by Vodacom is the one where you block all content, and then you can opt in. And others will opt in and say, and in opting in to that site, you then have to produce your ID, which ID is verified and obtain the Home Affairs database. And then if it's a sort of child or that's less than a particular age, it's not allowed. That's the system that's being put in place. There has been hiccups on it because it has been developed since the last time that we made the presentation to this committee. But those hiccups are the hiccups that are being addressed. That's one part of it. That's in relation to the steps that are being taken. Now, in terms of the alignment process on processes that are being put in place, saying with this legislation that is being amended, all we're saying is that the type of amendment that is being put into this law will provide the alternative to phrasing of the different clauses of the amendment. We're not saying, we're also aligning ourselves with the requirements of this amendment in the same way that we're doing that with another law that's called the Regulation of Interception and Communication Related Policing Act, where we are required by that law to actually register all phones against an ID and an address of a person and name, full name. That includes registration. If it's a child that owns a phone or a number, then you have to register the name of that person. Some of those measures, they filter and actually align into what the Freedoms and Publications Amendment Bill is trying to do. In that will change. Actually, we will end up having information on every number that is being used on a network, or that somebody buys a SIM card and has a number and is going to use it on a network, that person registers that number against a name, an ID number, and address. So you would know who belongs to that particular number. So that the alignment process that I'm trying to indicate here, it's an ongoing thing, honorable member. We have to take into consideration all the legislation that is put in place. The ECT Act, the Electronic Communication and Transactions Act of 2002, required us to do certain things. As a result, the department then put, the Department of Communication, that's the one that monitors that act, put out the guidelines in terms of that act,
and said we must then comply with that IRC code. That's why we are amending it in order to comply with that. The ECA mandates the CASA to do that monitoring process. Whatever code or industry body is put in place or code of conduct, the CASA has got to make sure, actually, the last, number one, the part and parcel of the approval of that code. Once we are signatories to that code, the CASA approves the code, becomes part and parcel of the entity that participates in the making of the code. And we always have them involved in that. Now, they monitor what happens in general in the ICT sector. They have that responsibility. We believe, and we're not suggesting that the MTB should be out of this, but rather should work with the regulator in making sure that these things happen. So all of that, we believe, is a process that needs to be aligned.
Chair, with your permission, in terms of, there was a question that said, what further steps can be taken to stop children at schools from downloading pornography? The answer is not, unfortunately, a simple one for anyone, any of us around this table, in that there are various ways and means to actually circumvent exactly those particular blocks we put in place. For instance, there's no ubiquitous tool available or filtering tool that will stop any kind of pornographic image, number one. We also sit with, as we stated, the internet being accessible and it's the ultimate open network. Quite a number of these particular websites where you can actually go and download from are not situated in South Africa. The moment those particular website owners realize that a filtering or block has been put in place, they merely move the website. So, if you place a particular block on a cell phone, we have been made aware that you can, in fact, from the internet itself, download software to take that block off your phone. So the child, you as a parent, have put that block in place on the phone. The child, and they are quite educated, our children these days can actually merely access the internet and circumvent it on that particular basis. Also, if a parent's cell phone is lying idle on a desk somewhere in the office, and your child gets hold of it, they can actually very quickly download something and then, via either Bluetooth or Bluetooth, as some adverts seem to suggest, sorry, I couldn't resist, download it to his or her own phone, and circumvent it that way, and on Bluetooth, on Bluetooth and on, for instance, infrared, that does not register with the cell phone companies at all. We wouldn't even know that it is happening. So our last slide actually states that this is going to be a very much a holistic problem where ourselves as parents will have to not only educate ourselves, but also make sure that we understand the very technologies that our children are utilizing to access images that might not necessarily conform to the parents' moral values or values for that matter. Chair, so
what is it that you are doing to change parents? And then tell me again the association of this joint presentation. This is the first time people coming for this presentation that we are appearing before the committee, therefore, guys, this is the mobile school of them. No. I see that. Let's deal with your role there, therefore. And again, just tell us the experience within the continent. I know that the MTN is doing quite a lot of work in a number of countries in the continent. And what I'm going to do is follow you. So, please give a go with our partners within the continent. And what are the challenges of your people got to having to deal with legislation in Nigeria, for example, where programs are coming in and Vodafone to try to say, take care of this impact everywhere. How do you deal with those issues there? And why is it very easy in South Africa, or in terms of the kind of the competition that we have there for, you know, we can come anytime. I'm not advocating for the share of the concession, but someone wrote in the one of the newspapers that the chairperson is saying that in the name of the concession, to the name of the concession. But look at the very issue that anything that we have made to come out here, and the concession of not advocating, we have to get that right now. But share with us your experiences, therefore, before we come to the main proposal that our sponsor has proposed. And I like the arrangement, you know, having the 50-50 balance to what I'm calling I like this arrangement. It's very, very beautiful arrangement. I think nobody has realized it. It's a good arrangement. But yeah, just share with us, because it takes me back to what we did now recently. We passed a decision on the South Africa. And we were saying that obviously the shining example is wonderful democracy as the country. It's wonderful, yes, but it's not the climate. In other parts of the country, of the continent, Nigeria, they just passed a law to totally ban what they call the political dependencies and all of that. So, to move in a particular way, because of the other side, checked and over there. I want to understand the challenges that you find as you have found. You use South Africa for those. Anything that the experiences that we learned is that we invite all of these wonderful technologies from outside of the continent. It may be pornography, pornography, and the men and women are coming in a sort of a list of this pornography that are here compared to the rest of the world. I was addressing these messages, this advent that you, in fact, are working very close with the broadcaster. That contains, unfortunately, that it's only in TV that advertises pornographic material. Some use it, telecom line, only a telecom line to download pornography. I know that it's part of where you make money, a lot of money. At some point, you must tell us how much you're making in Ghana on this advert on the pornographic material. I just want to have a feel of your understanding of the challenges that you develop. Everyone wants to grow the market. The market is huge in the continent. But you find that there is quite a resistance towards Africans as a way of dealing with certain things. And the issues of pornography, I think that maybe I'm not saying I'm an African and African, but I think that are very much foreign compared to our culture tradition. And therefore we are inviting and we are exporting this technology. And what I find again, what worries me, is that mostly it's women and it's white women. Very few that will pick up, you know, a woman of African women or something. Mostly it's white women that are in this central channel. We can go to interact with this community within the family. You'll see that in the school level of the children, the child, is a picture, you know, of a huge white woman. What is white women who are exposed to this kind of thing? What's for? And myself, I was asking myself this question that is the market specifically designed for white women in general, or what's happening? Just for me to understand, you know, because we're trying to legislate something that there may be people who really like it. I know that yesterday, as we were giving some presentation, we end up dealing and discussing the issue of sex. And then someone who was presenting started to smile. And the question that we asked was that, why now do you smile? He says, no, because I like sex. The general misunderstanding, I know that nobody likes to pose all of these funny questions. But to me, they mean a lot. Yes. Essentially, to do something. If we don't have your understanding of what is it that we're trying to do, we may not be able to achieve it. So there are a number of things that I think that we have to do.
Chair, with respect to you, there are some of your comments which I will not address for fear of actually turning a red like a tomato. However, during example, for instance, and here I'm going to ask my colleagues to actually chip in wherever as well, because I certainly don't have all the answers. Our Nigerian counterpart parts sit actually with a far bigger problem than ourselves in that, as you quite rightly mentioned, pornography has been completely banned in that particular country. But they do sit with exactly the same issues that we have, is access to the ultimate open network being the internet. What they are doing very specifically, I cannot answer that here today. I will make sure that I will inform the committee still during this week as to what specific steps MTN Nigeria have taken to comply with the laws in Nigeria. From an industry perspective, it took us quite a long time to actually discuss and agree on the IRB code, as well as also the memo that we have, the code of conduct that we have between us. It is never an easy thing for the three operators to sit together and try and hammer out something that they all agree with. However, we have also very recently, as we stated in our presentation, agreed that a number range has been agreed where only dare I call it pornographic images or images of a questionable content will only be accessible via that particular number range. That is another attempt or a foot.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to add to what Graham is saying, I think the problem that we sort of experience this issue more in South Africa is the pervasiveness of the internet. It's fundamentally that. As the internet grows in any particular country, you find this type of problems, which unfortunately you can't really handle them, all of them, through technology or counter-technological activity. Always lag behind negative activity, let me put it that way. And if you look at what is happening with mobile phones, it may be a bit scary going into the future, in that we won't necessarily have the capability to address all these issues as they confront us. Just as I think about a month or two back, a new type of handset that has come into the market, which is HSDA enabled. There are some that are coming in that are Wi-Fi enabled, which means if you go to a hotel that is a Wi-Fi hotspot, you will be able, with your handset, to actually access the internet and then move through and surf through using that phone. Now, in DRC and Tanzania, Vodacom hasn't, even in Mozambique, we haven't really experienced that much. Actually, let me say, we are not aware. It's not a question of experiencing it, it's a question of not even being aware whether that is a problem or not. And I think it's basically because also it's a relatively new market. I mean, they are hardly more than 5 years. And as compared to South Africa, whose penetration is reaching 75% now in terms of the number of SIM cards that are out there, you would imagine now the initial handsets that people had were simple handsets that you would probably be able to phone and have and do an SMS. People are able today to upgrade those handsets into handsets that allow you to get GDRS, to get Edge, to get pretty. In the process, you are able to get into what size, to the result of that. So I think fundamentally it's the internet. And in the internet environment, there is software that bypasses even the network, that cannibalizes our network. You are not making as much money as you can. And I mean, things like Skype, which people, I mean, there's roughly about how many users now? About 100 million users worldwide. People download software onto their phones and they are able, as a result, to bypass network. Nobody can deal with them. We cannot deal those people that are using Skype. And it's a software that's out there and they're using the same sensor. The question is, how do we control it? So I think it's the pervasiveness of the internet that's causing this, and it's going to grow. There's another element to it that perhaps legislature somewhere along the line will have to look at, is that the country is promoting e-education. We have obligations presently to put internet access in schools. It's an obligation, so we don't have a choice. We've got to put that internet access into those schools. Those children are going to have email addresses. Now, what I've learned in this from a friend of mine in Australia is that when they introduced e-education, pedophilic activities rose by 40% in Australia. When that happened. Now the question is, what security measures are going to be put in place in order to address that? Hence our closing statement that says, it's all of us working together that will try to address the issues that are confronting us and our society. But that's the experience. We'll try and get more facts on what is happening in those countries so that we can then provide the community with more tangible information on what possible measures we can put in place rather than what we are trying to put in place.
So you don't have information?
Not much.
And how do you relate to those MTN in Nigeria? What sort of thing? Is that one company, separate company?
Now all of the different operations operate by separate companies. In some instances we have majority control, in others we don't. But we do know, I mean, we have a very close working relationship with some regulatory individuals in Nigeria, and I will certainly make sure that I contact them and get the tangible information so that I can provide it to yourself, as well as some of the other jurisdictions where we do operate in.
You know, there's one thing I like about this committee is that one makes commitments and we follow up. Let me give members a watch call. I wanted this discussion just to have this field first, you know, and have a full understanding of the issues. I see Norma Kipela, Putin Romusha. K05, stop, are you okay? Inka? Are you sure? Okay. Let me do it for you. Okay, let's take
the... Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think after this I'm a little covered, because my worry was about the IP, where when you subscribe, you've got your ID number there so that they can see that it's an adult. But what if my child gets my ID and use my ID to subscribe? You see, those are some of the things, because our children are very intelligent, very clever, especially when it comes to technology. They can do anything. So you won't be exactly sure, that I'm definitely sure that, you won't be sure that it is an adult who has done this, just because the age of the ID says it's an adult, but being a child of 7 years.
So which means the point you're raising, Mama, is maybe around the issue of verification, the information. Shall we start respond to the Australian motion? I understand that they know Australia has a defense from the identified criminals. I wish not telling me. The defense from the identified criminals. Do you have that?
In terms of that MOU, the reason why we had to work together is because of the number ranges that we allocate allow these wireless applications that the providers to use. And in coming up with that code, we had a look at how they dealt with wireless application service providers in other countries. Because everybody is faced with this problem of any kind of content is available via WAS, and they're using the mobile networks in order to convey that content. And what we noticed is in most countries, including Australia, they have a separate number range for adult content. And they from what I can recall, they follow a kind of phased approach where, first of all, they introduce a separate number range for adult content, educate consumers in terms of the nature of the content provided by that number range, and then introduce technology that could block access to that number range. So in terms of, but one point that is, I think, very important is to note that adult content, the content of a sensitive nature, can be accessed by three means. Between subscribers themselves, they can send photographs, they can access the internet, and then via WAS. And the only point where we have a certain measure of control, the mobile operator has a certain measure of control, is with WAS. And that's exactly why we focused all these MOUs and IRB code on specifically WAS, because that is the only place where we can actually exercise limited control.
Okay. And last question, Chairperson. I just want to find out, because here they place an obligation on us not to place advertisements depicting explicit sexual content and must not be placed in general media. I just want to find out what happens if discrepancy occurs.
So that's part of my team, and I'm not going to expose my team. And the other team is right at the back again. So just, we are not even up to your point that you're raising. So if that's what you have, and we'll be able to go back to the team. It was myself that proposed. So that's which may have also, and then we'll have to sort of say,
thank you, Chief. Due to the nature of the relationship between the mobile operators and the wireless application service providers, and we are able to enforce membership to the Wireless Application Service Provider Association. And they have got their own code of conduct, which we've all had input into, and it regulates the way that they are allowed to advertise and generally behave. And whilst by then act as the industry body that also enforces their MOU, or their code of conduct, sorry. And if WASPA finds that they, for example, inform the WASP that they should stop doing something, or should pay a penalty for contravening the code, and that WASP doesn't comply, WASPA then approaches the network operators, who will then inform the WAS that we'll take him down, which means we will not allow him onto our network. And I think it happened once or twice with WAS that didn't comply with the WASPA code of conduct. In other words, if it reaches the point when they do not comply to the level that WASA has no control over them, they will not be able to sell their content via our network streaming. If I may just add that the operators have been very involved in the Fifth World Summit patrolling that was held in Santana last month. As part of that process, we actually recommended, together with the focus team, that there needs to be more emphasis on media and technology literacy, not just the children in school, but also adult literacy. Similarly, we've also been involved in the processes leading up to the Consumer Protection Bill. And that the bill actually provides for the consumers to have more information about products. And in this instance, it will allow them more information on the content that should be provided to them. So it gives them more options than they previously had.
Thank you very much. In fact, you observed most of your events that you follow, and for example, the Vodacom, the Cup, the soccer team. Wonderful events, the biggest event in social media. The only thing that advertised is Vodacom. It's only Vodacom that is advertised. No other message except Vodacom. Wonderful event, very big. Whole country said what he was doing. And that's the time that he can draw in information about issues of children, protection, development, and the end of life, you know, throughout. I'm saying that there is a platform created for you to reach out to a majority of the people, especially with regard to education and information. Because you see, we are basically technology and tools that we have for cell phone. Therefore, the usage, therefore, may be very complex. You know, even when you buy it, you have some kind of, you know, but it sounds like the parents, most of them can use the cell phone, but they buy cell phones for their children. You know, when we came to Parliament in 1984, that was for the first time, in fact, I touched what we call a cell phone. We had a class here in Parliament. We were saying, on Mike Maharaj, Trevor Manuel, all of them, we were saying how to use a cell phone. And it would ring, and Mike Maharaj did not know what to press. Because the guy was helping us on the at night using the landline, that this thing is ringing, what button must I press? So most parents not have time to, you know, to understand and to understand. The target is the children, and that's where the gap is. Even anyone can tell you here that the child is more advanced than the parents on the experience. The downloading, the white pictures, and all of that. That's why I'm saying that this pornography, parents may not be able to get to society, but the children are not able. So there must be a way that we can to try and address the challenge. It's a very challenge. We have a responsibility. We have a responsibility of trying to bring in legislation in place. But it's clear that with the many technologies developing, it's quite very difficult. But we still have a role. We cannot just keep things in place. With the little profit that you are making, look at the way of protecting our children. Therefore, we look into your watch for, but the very first concern that the issue of the advent, this advent that is being achieved, we should be concerned today. That's only the cause of this kind of watch for, because that's where you then have this peer to peer thing. The economic government will SMS that number, get download the demographic, and distribute it. This is what the children, you know, and totally there is no control. It's something that the committee is going to get quite generous on. Without bringing in sympathy for us, because we're now dealing with very similar concepts of downloading what's called a pornography and using say watch for the youth, and you get all this sort of watch for newspapers, in fact, they advertise this number. You check the last page of any newspaper, I mean, there's a section that is other than server, they call it entertainment, I don't know what it is, but it's a much. So you find all these numbers, and nobody's checking them. In newspapers, you just place an advert. The newspapers themselves don't go and verify what is it that is in that number. You know, so people just dial the number, and then they can listen to whatever they want to listen to or anything. So it seems as if there's no control there, and people talk about self-regulation, and all of that. But clearly there's no control. Therefore, the state will have to come in. We have to come in at some point and say, this must come to an end by doing this thing. So we have to do that. We have to do that in the name of protecting our children. Because that's the future generation of this country. That the ones who carry on this wonderful democracy that you fought for and I fought for us. And if we don't do that, we'll never have a society. If we don't do that now, we want to put profit before anything else, we'll definitely not even have a problem. When we are now dealing with issues of HIV, dealing with issues of rape and all of these things, abuse of women and all of that. And they use all of these things that form part of the influencing mindset of our children. Therefore, I think it's a challenge that we must get quite successful. And allow us to make this thing right. Don't fight with us only. Allow us, but together we will be able to arrive at some kind of an agreement. We will definitely take into account your recommendations. But any time you follow me, you've made a commitment that will come in some of the information through our committee section against this work of information to our president and to our people. Thank you very much for having a wonderful day. After going on the journey, thank you very much. Night is arranged. Ready? Yeah, let's grab some little bit of a. What Salamin is arranged, that the brown muffins again and brown muffins. First year they're eating brown muffins. Okay, thanks.
Sorry, so what is your name?
Are you going to arrest me?
No. I know you can blame in my report.
I can do what?
When I write my report for PMG, then I know who to blame.
Oh.
And he was, so there was another gentleman who was sitting over here as well.
Where?
About here somewhere.
Vietnam.
No. Well, right on the corner. I thought he was...
Kakani.
Ah, that's fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.